picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. Hello and welcome to the Weekly Stuff Podcast with Jonathan Lack.
And Sean Chapman.
We are here to talk about stuff. This week on the show, Jordan Peele's second film, Us, has arrived in theaters. Jonathan got an early look at DC's Shazam. Sean's been playing Sekiro, the new game by From Software. Google's announced a new gaming platform. And Disney is one step closer to their terrifying goal of complete world domination. All this and more on an absolutely packed episode. It might be too packed. We'll see how it goes. Sean, how have you been? We were off last week just for life stuff. What's up?
I have been pretty good. Let's see. One thing that was fun that happened since the last episode was we had a massive blizzard in Colorado.
Oh.
So I got two snow days back to back. Since I'm a high school teacher now. Snow days are a thing again for me, which is, that's cool. And
we've actually had really nice weather in Iowa, like a day where we didn't have to wear a coat.
Yeah, all of your Iowa weather came down to Colorado to visit.
Yeah.
It was like, hey, what's up? It's going to get... Like, the reason why we had two snow days in a row wasn't necessarily because the roads continued to be undrivable on the second day, but it was because there were so many power outages that still weren't fixed that there were a bunch of schools in the Jeffco School District that still did not have power.
That's
wild. So it was like, well, yeah, you can't really go to school if you can't turn the lights on. It'd be a little bit difficult.
I have been on spring break, so I'm going back to school tomorrow. Your spring break starts tomorrow, right?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, so I have been on spring break. I did not travel anywhere. I mostly stayed home and worked. I went into, Sean, one of the most suffocating writing binges of my life. And I say suffocating, it was actually very fun to just focus on writing this much. I wrote what was supposed to be a 20-page research paper. It's 46 pages now that it's done. So, you know, more than double. That was like 12,000 words. I did that. I have this screenwriting class I'm doing, and we were supposed to have 10 pages of our, like, full finished screenplay by the Monday after spring break. I'm currently at 35. So I'm like way ahead of the curve on that. When you add in all the, like, notes I wrote and everything for my essay and everything, I've written, like, 100-some pages this week, and it feels good. I have not just gone on that just absolute writing bender since I was much younger, and it's, you know, it's been nice. And I did get out of the house a little bit. I went down to Des Moines, visited some family, got myself a fancy new iPhone. It's orangish. Uh-huh. It's coral. It's the iPhone XR is the one I got. My iPhone was a little long in the tooth. It was about 2.5-3 years old. And Apple, because the iPhone XR is not selling that great, they're like trying to throw it at people. Like they brought the price down, then they upped the trade-in price, and I was like, oh, it's getting close for me, but I don't know. Then they created a deal where they could do the trade-in price and have you do a monthly installment plan. So I have a really nice phone for like $20 a month, which to me is like worth it to like, because I had paid my old phone off, but you never know when those things are just going to bust on you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I don't want to be in the position where that happens and Apple is not offering like a generous trade-in plan and my phone has no value anymore. So I'm like, I'll do that. And it's a nice phone. This is the first of the new ones I've had where they do the like Face ID instead of the fingerprint scanners. It is surprisingly good. It's like very fast. You never have to think about it. It's secure. It's got the like weird notch and curved screen. All of that works better than you would think. This is the one that's an LCD screen, not an OLED, but it's like the nicest LCD I've ever seen in a phone. It's really cool. Like, I can tell why Apple is having trouble selling this, because all the cool things about it, you resolutely cannot put in an advertisement. Like, you cannot describe the quality of an LCD or your fucking stupid Face ID thing. You have to like actually like demo those things. Mm-hmm. And I find it kind of funny. But anyway, it's also is a nice cool color and I like that. So, you know, just trying to liven up my life.
There you go. Liven up your life with an orange phone.
Yes. I also saw some movies. We're going to talk about that. Obviously, we're going to talk about Us later, Sean. That's the new movie right now. It made $70 million this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Great stat about that is that that is the highest opening for a live-action movie that is not based on a pre-existing property since Avatar.
Wow. Yeah, geez.
So it's been 10 years since a live-action movie based on a not based on a property like Captain America or something opened really big. So that's nuts. That's pretty cool to me.
Yeah, which like not to take away any of that accomplishment, but I would also just love to see what are other movies that are even in that bucket that made significant amounts of money, because it's hard, other than I guess something like Get Out. I guess most horror movies are not based on existing properties. But
well, like for instance, it's like I think the second highest horror opening ever or something, and the biggest is the next one is Halloween, the recent Halloween, which is the third movie called Halloween.
So yes, yeah.
And then the other one I think is It has the biggest horror opening, and that of course was huge, but it's based on a very well-known Stephen King novel, and It itself was the second movie about that Stephen King novel. So yes, we're not exactly in a time of like great originality right now, so pretty cool. I mean, Sean, I think you can hear it in our voices. I fucking loved this movie. I'm not going to say anything more about it until we get to the spoiler portion. All I can say is, Sean, I've never been so happy to have a podcast where I could sit down with you and talk about this fucking movie. I love it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm with you. It's because it's hard to talk about the movie without giving things that feel like you're giving something away. So if people are listening to this and have not seen Us yet, you should go see Us. It gets 2 thumbs up, like full-bodied recommendation from both of us. It is awesome.
It's the goods.
Yes.
Jordan Peele, man. It's crazy. I love how he's like building a like Hitchcockian brand identity for himself, complete with he is hosting a horror anthology show on television with The Twilight Zone, which I cannot wait for that either. I'm going to have to sign up for that stupid CBS streaming service because it looks really good. All right. So let's see. You want to talk about some stuff, Sean?
Yeah, let's talk about some stuff, Jonathan.
Why don't I kick off with a movie review for a movie that doesn't come out for a couple weeks. Yesterday, DC previewed Shazam, the next movie, the one starring Zachary Levi, and the second movie this year about a character named Captain Marvel. They previewed that in American theaters on Saturday. You had to buy tickets through Fandango, and it was like a Fandango promotion thing. But I thought, hey, I'm not doing anything today on this Saturday. I would like to see Shazam. I'll go see it early. It'll be good podcast content. Shazam is a really interesting movie, Sean, because a lot of it I love. Like, the things I like about Shazam, I like more than any other DC movie in the like DC extended universe. Zachary Levi is fantastic. It's the most fun anyone has had playing a superhero in years. Like, the closest would honestly be something like Brie Larson's Captain Marvel, but even then she has a little more like baggage to contend with. He's getting to play it fully as I'm a 14-year-old kid in Zachary Levi's body being a superhero, and it's very similar to the experience of like Tom Hanks in Big. He just nails that. It's a lot of fun. The kid who plays the other half, the Billy Batson, the actual 14-year-old kid, is a kid named Asher Angel. He's really good as well. He and Levi do a good job making that character seem like one person. Asher Angel also he's a boy. He looks fucking identical to Maisie Williams in the early seasons of Game of Thrones. Facial features, cheekbones, haircut. It distracted me the entire movie. That's neither here nor there. I just thought it was funny. But he's really good. The whole plot is Billy Batson. It has been like moving around foster homes his whole life. And he gets to this new foster home in Philadelphia, which also I liked Philadelphia as the setting of a superhero movie. There has not been a superhero movie set in Philadelphia. So that was fun. But he goes to this new foster home, and all of the kids at the foster home are also really good young actors, really fun characters. They do a lot of fun things with those characters over the course of the movie. And when it's focusing on Billy and his new powers and his friends and him getting to be a superhero and some of that stuff, it's great. It is so much fun. It feels like if superhero movies were a regular thing in the 80s, this is what a superhero movie in the 80s would have been. And I mean that like best way possible. Like, it gives me kind of a vibe similar to like The Goonies or something in that way. And I can't overstate, Zachary Levi is fantastic. He is so funny. The movie itself is really funny. Like, this movie's going to be a hit. I could tell just because of the audience reactions to a lot of the movie were pretty off the chart. It is very funny in a lot of places. Sadly, there's this other half of the movie, which is, you know how superhero movies sometimes have really boring villains, Sean?
Yeah, no, more often than not, yes.
Yeah, that doesn't describe Shazam. It's worse than that.
Shazam,
Shazam has the most boring superhero movie villain I've ever seen. He's played by Mark Strong, who I love. Mark Strong is a great actor. If you watch, like, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, he's great in that. The Kingsman movies, oh, he's great in that. But sometimes, like in the Robert Downey Jr. Sherlock Holmes or Kick-Ass or now this, he gets cast just to play kind of generic white bad guy dude. And it is so generic in this movie. And it wouldn't be that bad if he, like, showed up in the third act and was there to fight Shazam, right?
Mm-hmm.
But Sean, this movie commits to me the cardinal sin of structures, not just in superhero movies, but like a normal three-act story in general, which is it opens with a prologue that is at least 10 minutes long, exclusively about the origin of the villain. That's a mistake. You open with an origin, like you have to open with your main character or something directly adjacent to your main character. Like Star Wars does not open with Luke Skywalker, but it opens with Leia, C-3PO, and R2-D2, who are all going to go meet Luke Skywalker. So, like, the connecting line is very clear, right?
Yeah.
Us, which we watched today, has a prologue. The prologue is about the main character. It's not about, I don't even know who you, there's no one in Us that is that, like, off, far off in the corner. They don't open with 10 minutes of Elizabeth Moss, you know?
Right, yes, yeah. The origin of, like, the rich white people in the movie. Yes.
And, like, in the first act of the movie, they keep cutting. There are three major sequences, the prologue and then two others, about the bad guy, like him getting his powers. Two of those occur before Billy Batson even becomes Shazam or meets the wizard. So you've, like, seen the bad guy go to the wizard's lair twice before your main character gets to do it. It is so batshit weird to me as a structuring thing. Like, Zach Levi doesn't show up for 40 minutes in the movie because of how much time they're giving to Mark Strong. And it just, it kills the pacing whenever they cut to him. And then the last, like, 50, 45 minutes of the movie are the bad guy comes in and it's an extended series of, like, not just one long fight, but it is, you know, kind of a tit for tat with him and Shazam. And it's just, it's like, it's way too much. It feels like the climax is half the movie. It kind of is. Mark Strong is very boring. And because of how they structure it, like, you spend all this time with Mark Strong without knowing in any way what his relationship to Billy Batson is. Like, you know, another movie that does something kind of like this is Sam Raimi's Spider-Man, in that as Peter Parker is becoming Spider-Man, you have Norman Osborn becoming the Green Goblin. But you don't see Norman Osborn on screen until Peter Parker sees him. And then you know, oh, I need to care about Norman Osborn because he's Peter's friend Harry's dad, right?
Yeah.
You also have Peter bitten by the spider before Norman does anything in his lab. So, like, Shazam just has it so out of order in that way. It gets a little over its skis. The movie is too long. It's about 130 minutes. I think you could trim that down a little bit, primarily with the Mark Strong stuff. And it's just the Mark Strong stuff is so dour and colorless and bland. And all the stuff with Zach Levi and the kids is so fun and vibrant. It kind of gave me whiplash. Like, by the end of the movie, I kind of just wanted it to be over because I didn't know what to think about it. Even though, again, there's a lot of things I loved. So I think it's a movie worth seeing. I would definitely recommend it. I really would love to see a sequel where they have a fun villain in there. I mean, what's kind of funny is that Dwayne Johnson is listed as a producer on this because at an early point in development, Dwayne Johnson was developing this so he could play Black Adam. And then they decided, no, let's do Black Adam in his own movie, and Shazam will have a different villain. That was a mistake. If you had put Black Adam in there, and I don't even know who Black Adam is, but I know he would have been played by Dwayne Johnson. That would have been fun. If they do that in a sequel, that would be fun, and it would all match. But this just was the wrong choice of villain, and it's too bad. But other than that, I liked Shazam.
What do you know, like, what supervillain Mark Strong plays?
Yeah, he's Dr. Thaddeus Stevens or something. And
oh, okay.
He's like the dark Shazam who gets the powers of the seven deadly sins.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, that's Black Adam would have been a better villain.
Like, it kind of makes sense as an origin story, and I think you could make it work if you treated him more like the Green Goblin in Spider-Man and had him, like, you prioritized better, had him a little more off to the side, didn't keep cutting away to him. But yeah, it's a scripting problem, which is funny because if you take all those scenes out of the script, I think it's actually a very well-written movie with good characterization. It is also, I will say, I guess this is kind of a spoiler for something that doesn't happen in the movie. They never call him Captain Marvel. Mm-hmm. And it gets distracting by the end because they keep trying to come up with a name for him. Because his name is not Shazam. That's just the word he uses. So they make jokes out of it. Like, oh, you're Captain Sparklefingers or you're Thundercrack. They're trying to do something with, like, the lightning. And I thought the payoff to that joke was going to be someone calls him Captain Marvel. And I thought, okay, they're not going to do it through the whole movie, but maybe the last scene. They never do. They just leave that line of jokes completely unresolved. I know, like, there's legal reasons, and also they probably don't want to confuse anybody, given that Captain Marvel is currently a billion-dollar movie out in the world. But it's still, I don't know, it's just, like, it's a little weird when you can't give the character his name.
Yeah. I have a question. As someone who has enjoyed DC's Captain Marvel / Shazam in the cartoons, in some comic books before, does he ever do the thing that I think is the coolest thing that he can do, which is you grab the villain, like, kind of from behind, like, kind of like a full Nelson sort of thing, hold him up, like, towards the sky, and then yell Shazam, and the transforming lightning bolt comes down, but instead of hitting Captain Marvel and transforming him to Billy Batson, it hits the villain and goes, "Fuck-a!" And it's like, fucking yeah, that's really cool. Does he
kind
do
of,
that?
Yes, yes.
Okay, good. Yeah. That's, I should probably see this movie then, because that's,
I think
that's,
if you, like,
that's the coolest thing that Shazam / Captain Marvel can do, and I'm glad that he seems to do this in the movie.
If you want, this is one of those cases where if you want the character of Shazam, Captain Marvel, go see it. I think they got that so well. They even go into the origin of his name and what the letters stand for. I mean, like, they're having fun. And see it if for no other reason. Jimin Honsu plays the wizard who, like, the wizard Shazam who gives him his powers. I wish he was in more of the movie. He's so fun in, like, this crazy makeup and beard and, like, you know, talking about, like, powers and, like, say my name so my power may flow through you. And it's so fun. I love him in this.
Cool.
Yeah. So anyway, that's Shazam. It's coming out, I think, the beginning of April. I can see why they did a preview. People are really going to like this movie. Even if there is that issue with the villain, like, it's going to be a crowd pleaser. Kids are going to love it. There were a lot of kids in my theater. Which leads me to my one other story, Sean. You can see on my outline, I wrote, "What is wrong with this fucking theater?" Mm-hmm. And what I'm referring to is the theater here in Iowa City that I've told stories about before. This time, Sean, I was in another new auditorium. I've not yet been in every auditorium because this has like 15 screens or something. And in this one, I come in. It's a fairly big theater. The sound is sounding nice from like the previews. I'm like, okay, this is going to work. And I go to sit at like the back of the front section because there's no one else there. I like being a little close. And there were a bunch of kids in the back. And I don't mind. It's a kid's movie. Kids being there is totally fine. I just might want to be a little further away.
Mm-hmm.
And I sit down and I look, and I'm comfortable. I'm like, this is perfect. And I look up at the screen and I'm like, that is the dirtiest screen I have ever seen. That screen is filthy. Like, there are scratches and holes and pot marks and dust and dirt on every inch of this fucking screen. And I'm right up on it and I can see all of it. I have to move back. I will not be able to watch the movie like this. And I move back, and I'm near some of the kids, which winds up being fun because there was this one kid who kept, like, yelling very obvious questions at the movie. Like, when Billy Batson goes to the Wizard's Lair, he's like, "This has to be a dream, Dad, doesn't it?" And I enjoy things like that because they're funny. But anyway, even from further back, it looked like I was watching a really beat-up 35mm print, but all the damage was just static over the entire movie. I can't believe they haven't cleaned that screen.
That's great. I must admit, I don't think I've ever encountered that problem before. I don't think I've ever noticed a screen being physically dirty because it just seems like a bit... Like, I get that theaters are getting more and more incompetent, but that's like a level of basic incompetence that is upsetting.
I mean, I've definitely seen, like, you might have a little hole in a screen or a tear or something like that, but it's like a single thing. This is like, this screen needs to be replaced. Like, if you had cleaned it regularly, you probably could have salvaged it, but they never did. So it's just like, oh my God, this screen is from 1975, isn't it? And it has not been cleaned since then. Anyway,
fantastic.
Yeah. When I went to see Us today, it was a much better experience, and the screen was perfectly clean. So I guess they just put Shazam in the theater for movies they don't like. I don't know. It was weird.
Yeah, well, you know, it's my favorite new ongoing joke of this podcast is all the weird shit that happens at that theater you go to now.
Yeah, I don't get it. I don't get it. All right. Do you want to pick a stuff, Sean?
All right, yeah. So I've sort of played two video games, which is my stuff, and I will talk about Sekiro first, because I think I'll probably end up talking a lot more about it next week, because I've only had time to start playing Sekiro today. I wanted to, because it came out on Friday, didn't have time to play it on Friday, wanted to play it yesterday, but my brother came into town and didn't have time to play it yesterday, so I only got started today. So I've only put a couple of hours into Sekiro Shadows Die Twice, which is the new game from Software, best known for Demon's Souls, the Dark Souls games, and Bloodborne. And Sekiro is really fucking good. I can already tell just a couple of hours. It's really impressive because it's very clearly made from that team and Miyazaki, who is the guy who is the creative lead on Demon's Souls, Dark Souls 1, Dark Souls 3, and Bloodborne, because he was not the creative lead for Dark Souls 2, which is sort of popularly the kind of the black sheep of the franchise. He is the creative lead on this game. It's that team, so you can definitely tell it's made by those people. But unlike something like Bloodborne, where it felt like a sort of different take on what was fundamentally the same thing as Dark Souls, Sekiro is a very different game. It has certain similarities, like it is very difficult. It has some interesting mechanics around respawning. It has, you know, a very basic sort of set of melee abilities that they use in creative ways to sort of make the combat very interesting and varied and challenging. But a lot of very key mechanics from the Dark Souls games are not here. Most importantly, like, if you die, you do not go back and pick up your souls or whatever from where you were. Like, that whole concept is gone. There's no multiplayer thing. There's no, like, invading. There's no calling people into your game to help you. There's no messages written on the ground. It is entirely a single-player game, which one nice benefit of that is this is the first one of these kinds of games where you can press the pause button and pause the game.
Yay. Because
since all the other ones were always online, they were designed so it's like, nope, if you want to change a weapon or do anything in your menu, you better hope there's no enemy around because you will get fucked up. This one, it's like, no, if you need to take a breather, you could just hit the pause button, and if you need to go take a piss, this is a video game you can play when you need to go to the bathroom, and that's nice.
It says that on the back of the box. It's a featured feature of the game.
Yeah, this is a featured feature. Is like, you don't have to, don't worry, if you need to go take a piss, you can do it with this video game. You don't have to, you know, rush through a boss fight or something, like, desperately if you have to go to the bathroom, which was a common experience when playing the Dark Souls games. But yeah, so that's very different. There's no stamina mechanic. That's completely gone, which that's huge. So you can basically just swing your weapon as long as you want, or you can block indefinitely. There's no stamina concept. What has sort of replaced stamina is this sort of posture mechanic. So Sekiro is set in a sort of fictionalized version of feudal Japan, and you play as a shinobi, which they like saying shinobi all the time. And the game defaults to the Japanese language as well, so I think there's an English dub, but it straight up comes up and says, this game's, like, default language is Japanese. It's like, okay, cool, awesome, thank you, you did the work for me. So
I hope the English dub is just, like, Americans, like, phonetically reading the Japanese.
Yeah, that would be fantastic. Yeah, I have not checked out what the English voice acting is like. I'm sure it's good, but the Japanese voice acting is definitely what you want. But since it is this sort of feudal Japan setting and concept, they make it feel like that in the gameplay. So it's very much about, like, countering with your sword and doing parries. It's not about getting behind a shield and guarding up the way that Dark Souls typically, like, that's kind of the default or standard way to play a Dark Souls game, was get a big hefty shield, like, get behind your shield, be safe behind that shield, and use that to sort of wait out enemies. Sekiro is kind of like if you look at the track of where they went with Bloodborne, where Bloodborne got it was a much more aggressive game than Dark Souls. Sekiro is like an exponential step forward even from that. So Sekiro is a very aggressive game. You are meant to be, like, pressing the attack constantly. It's incredibly active, because if you try to block too much, you will get staggered by the enemy and they will take you the fuck out. And this is a game where, you know, it's the kind of game where the most paltry enemy, if you are not paying attention, will be able to kill you very quickly. So you always have to be on your guard. And then the game is really based around you having to try to use your different sort of attack mechanics to knock your enemies back and sort of defeat their posture, either through parrying or using your different attacks. And then once they are staggered and their posture is broken, you can deal what they call a death blow and kill enemies in one hit. So that's, like, the pace of the game, is more based around that, which feels a little bit more like Neo, which is the Tecmo Koei Dark Souls style game, but this is even more aggressive than that game was. So yeah, Sekiro, it's really intense, it's really fast paced. I really like they made the story is much more explicit this time. It's not the like Dark Souls-y, like here's some vague fantasy bullshit that like you have to watch 5 YouTube videos to figure out what's like really going on. And it's not about as much the like sort of vague environmental storytelling. This is a story where you play a shinobi known as the Wolf or Okami, who was... It's got a great opening cinematic where you see you were like picked up on the battlefield by some guy who works for the Ashina clan or part of the Ashina clan, who's sort of the main clan you're a part of. And you get trained as a shinobi as this clan, and then you serve this young master who is... I haven't figured out entirely what his role is, but he's some sort of like spiritual leader or something, some sort of spiritual figure named Kudo. And at the beginning of the game, an enemy clan attacks your clan and kidnaps Kudo. And in the ensuing conflict, your like left arm gets cut off, and then it gets replaced by with a prosthetic arm. That's sort of one of the main gimmicks of the game, is you can put different tools in this prosthetic arm, like a big axe or like a fire kind of flamethrower thing, or a thing that shoots shuriken. That you find different tools you put in this arm to get different abilities throughout the game. And so the story is about you hunting down the people who have taken your sworn master and presumably getting him back. So it's a much more explicit story. It's a very clear setup. Your character you play as, Sekiro's or Okami, is fully voiced, which is something that these games have never done. So you feel like you're playing this very sort of stoic shinobi samurai kind of character. And that's something I've been having a lot of fun with, is playing one of these games with a story that feels like it's trying to tell you things and trying to be a more character-based story, at least at the beginning, which is something that this team has never tried to do before. So early impressions of Sekiro are, it's really cool. I'm really excited to dig deeper into it. I feel like after the first 3 or so hours I've played, I'm starting to get a handle of how they've changed up the combat so much. And when, like, I'm getting to the point where when I enter a new area, I can start clearing motherfuckers out, and like killing very weak enemies is incredibly satisfying, because once you get a handle of the combat mechanics, you can just blow through motherfuckers so fast and just stagger them immediately and cut their fucking heads off or slit their throats and do all the, like, the very graphic but very satisfying finishing attacks that they have in the game. So if you have enjoyed the Dark Souls style games, Sekiro is definitely, you probably already picked it up, but it is definitely worth getting. I'm happy to be playing a new video game that has come out in the year 2019, because this is the first one I think I've played.
I still have not. I have not bought or played a new video game this year. I have bought old video games and played them. I am still on my Destiny bullshit, and I don't know. It's again, as I've said before, it's the closest to addiction I'm probably ever going to get. Like, I mean, fingers crossed I'll ever get. I just don't know how to give it up. I don't know. Will nicotine gum help me with this, Sean? Is there a Destiny-flavored gum I could chew and, like, not play Destiny?
I don't know. Anthem. I think Anthem is, like, the nicotine gum of loot shooters.
Except it would take up roughly the same amount of time. No, I don't know. Do you think I would like Sekiro as someone who bounced off Bloodborne and Dark Souls on multiple tries?
I have no idea. It's hard to tell, because it is a different enough game that I think there's a chance that you would find something in it you would like. Because it's definitely, it's not like Bloodborne, where Bloodborne was so similar to Dark Souls that I would find the idea of someone liking Bloodborne but not liking Dark Souls would be kind of strange to me. I can definitely see somebody liking Sekiro and not liking those other games. Because also, Sekiro is not even, like, it's not an RPG. You don't level up. You don't have, like, stats in Sekiro. It's a very sort of, like, more action-focused kind of game. So there's a chance. It is still brutally fucking difficult. Like, it is, if you are someone that does not want to do, like, a very difficult action game, Sekiro is probably not where you want to go. But, yeah, so I don't know. Like, if I were you, I would give it a shot, because I would love for you to get into one of these games.
I would, but too. So I might still, I've been in a weird mood where, like, I haven't been playing video games much other than Destiny, and it's felt really good. It's been, like, a cleanse. I mean, I am still playing a video game with Destiny, you know? But, yeah. Like, I don't know. It's, like, I've been spending time, like, I've been catching up on The Flash on the CW. I've been having a lot of fun with that. I've been watching movies. I did all this writing this week. you know, it's just it's a different like little set of priorities, and this has not been a crazy active year for video games yet. Or I mean, maybe it's been active, it just hasn't felt like it's come to me yet. So we'll see. I'm sure I'll get back into the swing of things at some point, because things are going to come out I want to play. I have that new Yoshi game pre-ordered. That's a very different game than Sekiro, though, so we'll see.
Yes. I would love a really intense, hard 3D like character action Yoshi game where he just rips people's throats out with his fucking tongue or whatever.
Yoshi, Goombas die twice.
Yes.
All right. Well, anyway, I have one other thing I want to talk about really quick for stuff. A movie I saw this week that is not Shazam and you might not have heard of, but you should because it's one of the most impressive movies to come out this year, which is Apollo 11. Have you heard of this, Sean?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, so it's a new documentary that is about the Apollo 11 launch, the mission to the moon in 1969. 2019 obviously is the 50th anniversary, and as like lead up to the 50th anniversary, NASA has been doing a lot of work to get archival content out. So for instance, they got all, it's like thousands of hours of all of the audio of the Apollo 11 mission. So every voice transponder, everyone who was talking into a mic at or around NASA, they have all the audio for that. And then as a separate thing, they uncovered something like 60 hours of 70mm footage captured on base at NASA, around NASA, in Cape Canaveral, where the launch was going off, of the launch itself, some even on the shuttle as it went to the moon. Now, this was for an unrelated documentary that was created in, like, the 70s, but is not all that notable. But all the footage came out again, they cleaned it up, and Apollo 11 is taking all of that 70mm footage, which again is like the highest quality celluloid footage you can get, plus all of that audio, and it is essentially a fly-on-the-wall documentary from when the day of the mission starts to when they get back to Earth 10, 14 days later. I think it's a two-week total. And you are just kind of a fly-on-the-wall of all of it. It is incredible to see this footage. It's amazing we did not know this existed. You know, there's stuff like a full-on 70mm shot of the rocket going off, and you see everything on the rocket as it's exploding and going up. No special effect in film history has looked that good. Like, this is the real fucking thing. And I love all of the footage on the ground of mission control, of hearing a lot of famous lines from the mission just coming out of the mouths of people who were speaking them. Like, the editorial lift this movie is doing to put all that together is crazy. It also has a bunch of 16mm footage. It's got footage of, like I said, people at Cape Canaveral just there to watch the launch, and you just get to see kind of that cultural moment. It is edited impeccably well. It has an amazing musical score. I would have said the best musical score of the year until Us came out, and now I'm like, Us might have the best musical score of the year, but the year is young. It's really an incredible movie. It's been playing kind of sporadically. It started in IMAX theaters. We don't have any real IMAXs in Iowa because our one real IMAX was in Des Moines, and the roof caved in because of rain, so they're trying to fix that. But anyway, so I actually had to drive like 30 miles to a theater in Cedar Rapids and then realized, oh my god, this theater's really good and it's really cheap. Tickets are like $5 and their popcorn was $3 and it was amazing. And then I went home and I'm like, and I don't live in Cedar Rapids, so if I ever want to go to that theater, I have to drive 40 minutes. Fuck, why can't we have that theater in Iowa City where we have a film school? It sucks. Not the point. Apollo 11, very good. You should see it. I love astronaut-related films. I love all the stuff about the moon landing. There was the film First Man last year by Damien Chazelle with Ryan Gosling that I think is an amazing movie. This is a really cool companion piece to that. It's going to be on CNN later this year because it was funded in part by CNN, and it'll be on DVD and Blu-ray, obviously. But see this in theaters. It is one of the most essential theatrical experiences I've ever seen. It's truly spectacular. So I just wanted to give that movie a shout-out because it's something pretty cool.
Awesome.
Yeah. So anyway, we don't do cool stuff like that anymore, like going to the moon.
No, yeah.
No,
the human
instead
race
now
definitely
we
fallen back.
Now we argue about how guilty is the president in obstructing justice. He did it, but how much did he do it? No, we don't do moon stuff.
Oh, man. I wish we did moon stuff still.
I know.
Moon stuff is cool.
All right. What else have you got going on, Sean, before we move on to the news?
So the other thing I've been doing is, I think I described this last podcast, that I was in a chicken match with Capcom and their pricing on PlayStation Network for the old Devil May Cry games. Since Devil May Cry 5 came out, it seems like it's really fucking good. I wanted to play it, but the only Devil May Cry game I had ever played was the reboot spin-off thing by Ninja Theory. And I wanted to play the old ones and see what they were all about, because I've always wanted to play them. And was waiting for them to put it on sale. And they fucking won that game of chicken, because I had two snow days back-to-back. And I had nothing much to do. And I was like, fuck it. It's only like $40 for four fucking video games. It's $10 a pop for when you divide it down. It's fine. I will just do it. So I bought the Devil May Cry HD Collection and Devil May Cry 4 Special Edition Package or whatever. Because the HD Collection is a port of the HD updates they did for Devil May Cry 1 through 3 that originally released on 360 and PS3. So that's not like a new update. That's just like they ported that over to be on modern consoles also. And then they did a special edition version of Devil May Cry 4 that is on modern consoles. So if you can buy a bundle that has both of those things together, it's about $40. That's what I did. And I have played Devil May Cries 1, 2, and 3.
That's not a lot.
Yes. So I played a lot of Devil May Cry. Although, I mean, I played Devil May Cry 1 and 2. I had both of those finished by the end of my two snow days. Partially because I played a lot of those games. Partially because both those games took me a total of 13 hours to complete. Because Devil May Cry 2 in particular, I think I beat that game in about 4 hours. It is not very long. Devil May Cry 2, also not very good. I was hoping I would be able to get through all four of them. Once I realized my pace was like so quick, I was like, oh, maybe I can do all four of them before Sekiro. Didn't quite do it because Devil May Cry 3 is a much more meaty experience. And honestly, I kind of want to play Devil May Cry 3 again because you unlock another playable character, Virgil, once you beat it the first time. And Devil May Cry 3 is very good. So just to give an overview of my feelings of Devil May Cry 1, 2, and 3. Devil May Cry 1 is a very interesting game that I enjoyed quite a bit, but it has definitely aged a lot. Because that game came out, I think, in 2001. So that game is
wow.
That game is 18 years old, which when I did the like comparison, I realized that more time has elapsed between now and the release of that video game than had elapsed between that video game and the release of Mario Brothers. Not Super Mario Brothers, Mario Brothers. So that's like to put video game history into perspective, because when I did that, I was like, holy shit, that's fucking crazy. That's how like old that game is, relatively speaking. Like if you had sat someone down in 2001 and played Devil May Cry, and then the next day they played the original Mario Brothers, it's the experiences are so different. So Devil May Cry 1 is a very like prototypical character action game, because it's kind of one of the first, if not maybe the first, of that genre proper. It predates something like the Ninja Gaiden game on the original Xbox by like 3 or 4 years. So it's an old game, and it definitely feels old, but there's a lot of really interesting things about it. Like Devil May Cry 1, I don't know if you knew this, Jonathan, but it was originally in development as Resident Evil 4. And so
I did not know that. Really?
Yes.
Wow.
So they gave Resident Evil 4 to, I think it's Kamiya. Hideki Kamiya was the guy who created the first Devil May Cry. And so he was designing something to be Resident Evil 4. And eventually it ended up starting moving so far away from Resident Evil was, because they were doing all this like melee combat kind of stuff and trying to make it cool and flashy, that they're like, let's just make this its own thing, spin it off. And then Shinji Mikami led a team to make the actual Resident Evil 4 that we know and love.
That's very much a best of both worlds situation, because you got like one all-time masterpiece and one new beloved series out of it.
Exactly, yeah. So it was definitely like really fruitful little arrangement they had.
Those, we can put it this way, Sean. Those are both games that are still being re-released and resold today.
Yes, yeah. Later. Yeah, so, and one of the things that's most interesting is kind of seeing a little bit of what you can imagine that Resident Evil 4 game was going to be, because it's all in this, like, very gothic castle. So for people who don't know anything about Devil May Cry, you play as a character named Dante, who is the son of Sparta, with a D, not Sparta, but Sparda, Who was a demon knight who sometime in the past in this world, like, saved humanity and sealed the demons away in hell. And he, and so Dante is like half demon, half human. And so he kind of has superpowers, and he opens up a demon hunting business that is called Devil May Cry. So that's why the games are called Devil May Cry, is because he runs a business called Devil May Cry, which is a bad name for a business. Doesn't make any sense, but that's what he does. So at the beginning,
Devil May Cry, I don't know. You might not.
Yeah. Devil. We'll see. And they really love writing hokey dialogue around devils never cry, devils may cry. It's bad. The writing.
They should have done that for like the sequel title, Sean. Devil May Cry. Devils never cry. Devils cry twice. Devil cries again. Like, that would have been a great series of sequel titles.
Yeah, and Devil May Cry 3 is actually a prequel to Devil May Cry 1. So they could have said, you know, Devils Cried Yesterday or something for your prequel. Yeah. Anyway, so at the beginning of Devil May Cry 1, a lady named Trish comes into the Devil May Cry business and kind of hires Dante to go kill a demon named Mundus, who Dante believes is the demon that defeated Sparta and is trying to invade the human realm again. And he's at some like weird island castle. So you go to a gothic castle, and for the original Devil May Cry, the first three Devil May Cry games, the camera is a fixed perspective. And so there, it's full 3D environments. So it's not like Resident Evil 1 and 2 and stuff where they were like, you know, basically photographs that they had polygons on top of. It's a fully realized 3D environment, but it's a fixed camera. Sometimes the camera will move, but you have no control over it. So you can definitely feel the Resident Evil, like you walk into a room and the camera angle shifts to a different perspective. And like that. So those little touches are really interesting to see. But like with Devil May Cry 1, the combat is very, very basic because it's such an old game. So it's basically you have like a 3-hit combo that, depending on your timing of your presses, you can do some minor variations of. You have a lunging move you can do, you have a launcher you can do, and you can unlock one other weapon type other than the longsword, which are these like gauntlets, but I never really use them because they kind of suck. So like the and then you obviously have your like the iconic pistols that he shoots, so you can launch people up in the air and like juggle them up in the air with the pistols, and that stuff is fun to do. But it's a very basic game, but you can definitely feel why it got so popular, because there's something about the structure and pace of the game where it's all one big environment, really. Like, the castle is one huge environment, and you end up going to like an alternate dimension, like negative version of the castle, in kind of the latter parts of the game to kind of make more use out of the geometry. But while it is one big environment, they section it off with like this mission structure where once you like complete an objective, like you defeat the boss or whatever, you get a big screen that pops up, gives you your mission rating, and then you like can save your game and then go to next mission. But whatever mission you're in, you can basically go wherever you want. And so it's a really weird structure that felt like they were playing with something. And like Devil May Cry 3 kind of does something similar. And so I just have never seen a game that was like, it's sort of open environment, but it does have like very strict missions that, and the missions are very like quick and snappy, because then it's just like there's like 18 or 20 of them. But they're all like, if you know what you're doing, you can finish most of them in about 5 minutes. It's a really different video game structure. And there's something about the pacing of that, of like, you're learning the whole environment and sometimes wrap back in on yourself and like kind of see areas that you've been through from a new perspective and get that kind of fun element that that kind of design can do, but also have the really sort of frenetic, fast paced, like really sort of, you know, kind of like carrot on a stick, like it's just constantly driving you forward, pacing of a more linear level based game. And so that's why like I played through all of Devil May Cry 1 in two sittings, and it took me about 8 hours to play that game. So Devil May Cry 1, very cool. If you're someone that is not super interested in like the history of it, I'm not sure if it's totally worth going back to, because there's also very little story content. There's no real reason to play it for story stuff that you wouldn't just get from a Wikipedia summary, unless you really want to get some of the really hokey dialogue in the game, like at the end of the game when Dante's like, devils never cry, tears are a privilege that humans have, your tears prove that you're a human. It's just like, or there's a classic, like very classic scene where Trish dies, she comes back, but she quote unquote dies, and then Dante's cradling her in his arms and he just screams out this line, I should have been the one to fill your dark soul with light.
That's amazing.
It's so good. Like, the voice acting is very 2001, and so there's something, like, almost, even though I'd never played this game before, there's something weirdly nostalgic about playing a very early PS2 game that made me feel like I should have, like, been drinking Mountain Dew and, like, watching X-Play after I finished a game. You know, it just was, it's so of that period of video games.
Oh, now I want to play it, just because you, like, that is such a, like, vivid, like, connection for people of our age, I think.
Yeah, it's just, it is funny that a game that I never played could take me back to that period, because it's so just, like, the epitome of that, like, early 2000s video game design.
You know how they have now those, I think Hyperkin makes those replicas of the Xbox Duke controller for the Xbox One. I feel like I should get one of those and get this for Xbox One and play it like that and just really, like, go hardcore with it.
Yes, and just get a Mountain Dew can, but that's not, but it's the old Mountain Dew logo that's, like, more rounded, because it's, like, that's, like, it's just, it so took me back to that period of my life in a weird way. So that's Devil May Cry 1. Cool game. Again, like, I would not say that people should force themselves to play it, but it's a cool historical kind of thing that's still fun. Devil May Cry 2, which is a game that I knew that people who played that like Devil May Cry do not like Devil May Cry 2. It's one of, like, the black sheep entries in a franchise that, like, people...
It's always,
like,
number two.
Yeah, it's like a Dragon Age 2 or something like that. There's, like, people like, I don't know if Devil May Cry 2. But I had never heard why people never liked Devil May Cry 2. It was always just like, Devil May Cry 2 is not good. And people were always like, Devil May Cry 1, pretty good. Devil May Cry 2 is shit. Devil May Cry 3 is really good. Devil May Cry 4 is pretty good. It has backtracking. It's like, that's all I've ever heard about Devil May Cry games. And so I just never knew why people don't like Devil May Cry 2. Luckily, Devil May Cry 2, it is a bad game. Devil May Cry 2, not a good video game. Luckily, the reasons in that it is not good make it a very easy video game to play, because it is just, it's super short. It has basically no story to speak of. The story is utterly irrelevant. Nothing about the story of Devil May Cry 2, as far as I understand, is ever carried forward in any way in all of Devil May Cry. Like, there's a whole second playable character they introduced named Lucia in Devil May Cry 2. That I believe the game was originally sold with two discs, one where you played as Dante, one where you played as Lucia. So when you boot it up from the HD collection,
that's interesting.
Yeah, before you even go to the title screen, you have to pick play Dante or play Lucia. And I was like, why the fuck is that? And I looked it up. It's because it was sold on two discs. Very weird. That Lucia character, as far as I know, has never appeared in any other video game ever. So it's like Devil May Cry 2 is very much in its own little sphere. It's a very easy game. Very, very short. You can basically beat almost every single boss by just walking up to them and just spamming the attack button over and over and over again. Which, in contrast to Devil May Cry, like, 1 or 3, both of those are pretty difficult games. Like, not, you know, it's not Sekiro, but they are pretty hard. Devil May Cry 2, I don't think I ever died at all. And I played it all in one sitting. I beat it,
oh, wow,
again, in, like, between 4 to 5 hours. If you cut out the cutscenes, I think probably, like, 4 hours long. It's just, you just blaze through that fucking game. It is just no friction, no resistance. But one thing that's interesting is so the game, from what I understand from looking up its development history, was made effectively in like a 6 month period, because they had a Devil May Cry 2 under development. It was a troubled production, and so they then brought in Hideaki Itsuno, who is the director for Devil May Cry 2, and then stayed on, and he made 3, 4, and 5. So he is the main Devil May Cry guy, but they kind of threw him on to try to save Devil May Cry 2. So he effectively, with his team, put that game together in like 5 to 6 months. And when you look at that, that is very, very impressive, because nothing about the game is actually broken. I encountered no bugs. No, like, nothing significant, like, that felt like the game was busted. It was just felt like the game was completely untuned and the bosses were, like, half-finished in terms of their attack patterns and stuff. But it's a totally playable game. It's just, like, it's a totally smooth ride. And so it felt like they just kind of cobbled together what they had and then smoothed it out as best they could and just kind of took some, like, rough sandpaper over the whole game and made it super smooth. And so it is, like, the most imminently playable bad video game I have ever encountered. There's no reason to skip it. You just, like, spend, like, an afternoon blazing through Devil May Cry 2 just for, like, the intellectual experiment of seeing, like, what is this game? Because especially nowadays, a bad video game is a game that is like half busted, and you know, like the game crashes every 5 seconds, and you encounter like weird loading screen bugs and shit, like, you know, the kind of shit that people ran into Anthem, or like Anthem would like fucking brick your goddamn console, that kind of shit. This game, no, it's just not that good. It's not
Sonic 06.
No, exactly. It's not Sonic the Hedgehog 2006. You're not running into like a loading screen, getting a line of dialogue, getting another loading screen, playing for 30 seconds and getting another loading screen. It's nothing like that. There's no like huge issues. It's just like the most video game ever created. It was just so fascinating because I was going into it expecting it to be like actively terrible. Instead, it was just like, it was like eating bread on its own. It's like just eating like a loaf of like a slice of white bread with nothing on it. It's just like, I guess I ate food. I think I technically played a video game, but it's like kind of felt like the game didn't exist. So that's Devil May Cry 2. Again, if you bought that HD collection, I fully recommend people playing it because it is a fascinating game that you will spend almost no time on in your life playing compared to any other video game. Devil May Cry 3 is a fucking masterpiece. Devil May Cry 3 is an amazing goddamn game. Holy shit. Like, it's incredible seeing, like, in the stretch of basically 4 years, because Devil May Cry 3 came out in 2005, what Itsuno's team took from Devil May Cry 1, the little things that they learned about from making Devil May Cry 2, that they incorporated a couple of things, like a dodge thing and that stuff that they put into that game. But they basically just went back and looked at Devil May Cry 1 and were like, how can we fully realize the vision of this game that because it was the first game of its type, it could only ever accomplish so much of what that vision was? And Devil May Cry 3 has so much like swagger and attitude. It is a tremendously fun, joyous, funny video game to play. Dante is a utter fucking goofball in the best way possible. And the combat is amped up so much. The combat is so much better in Devil May Cry 3 than the two previous games. You have a whole wide selection of different weapons you unlock over the course of the game. You can switch between weapons smoothly within combos. And Devil May Cry 3 is the first game of this series to fully nail this like style mechanic they had been going for, which is every time you enter a fight, there's a little like number or a letter that pops up in the corner of the screen that goes from D, C, B, A, S, double S, triple S, that kind of ranks the style of how well you are playing in that combat encounter. In Devil May Cry 1 and 2, it's this totally sort of like ephemeral nothing mechanic that is not tutorialized or explained. It doesn't feel fully fleshed out or like considered. In Devil May Cry 3, it's a totally active part of the game, and it's very clear to you through like little visual indicators they've done and tweaking how long like it and how hard it takes to move the number between stages or the letter between stages to improve your style. It becomes very clear what you need to do to engage with that side of the game. And them giving you all these other tools to mix in different kinds of attacks allows you to really engage with that. Because the way the style mechanic works is you obviously if you ever get hit, you get knocked back down to nothing. So it's kind of like almost like a combo sort of counter. But it's not just a combo. It's also keeping track of how frequently are you using the attacks in your arsenal. Because if you're just using three attacks over and over again and just cycling between those three attacks, you're never going to build up that style meter. Like, you will probably be able to win this combat encounter, but if you don't get a good style rating, you're not going to get a lot of experience points to unlock new moves and abilities and improve your life bar and stuff like that. And so you want to be getting this combo up really high, but at the same time constantly making use of every single attack that is available to you, because the more variety you introduce to it, the higher and quicker your style rating is going to improve. And so that's, I think, a really smart way to prevent the bad habits that players like myself can develop in a game like this, which is finding the handful of attacks that you know really well that are very effective and just using those over and over and over again in every fight, which is basically how I played Devil May Cry 1 and 2 because they allowed that very easily. Devil May Cry 3 motivated me to be like, no, I'm going to use everything I have, and I'm going to be switching between my sword and these fucking like ice nunchucks and then popping people up in the air and shooting with my guns and switching to this big sniper rifle and blowing like five enemies away with it, and then and using all my different like launchers and like, you know, closing attacks that allow me to like jump and get close to enemies. They introduced these four different styles to the game that allow you to pick a style that gives you access to different moves, like a really fast dodge attack, or something that will give you an additional attack type on every weapon you have, or one like the gunslinger style that will improve the way that you can use your guns and give you new gun abilities in combat, which allows a lot of replayability and like personalization of the combat. And compared to the very, very sort of static basic system in Devil May Cry 1 and the kind of frictionless nothing system in Devil May Cry 2, it is phenomenal to me that they came out and just the transition between those two games, Devil May Cry 3, is such a fucking incredible climactic leap forward for that genre and for that franchise. It is unbelievable to me that all three of those games came out on the same fucking console generation within 4 years. It is insane. Devil May Cry 3 is an incredible game. If you are playing Devil May Cry 5, or you played DMC, or you played any of these character action games, I think you owe it to yourself to go back and play Devil May Cry 3, because it 100% holds up. It plays buttery fucking smooth. It is amazing.
Yeah, I was on my phone while you were talking, looking it up on PlayStation 1, because I was like, what if it like just went on sale and I could make that joke in this segment? That would be great, and also I could get it. But two, I kind of want to play that now.
It's very good. It's fucking...
Yeah.
It's so good. I want to play... After I finish Sekiro, I'm probably going to go back and play it again through with the Virgil character before I move on to Devil May Cry 4. But Devil May Cry 3 was fucking awesome. That game holds up spectacularly well.
Awesome. All right. Well, any other... We did a very long stuff segment this week, but we've been off for a couple weeks. So I had fun with this. You want to move on to the news, Sean?
What the fuck's going on in the news, Jonathan?
So I'm just going to preview this. The news is going to end on kind of a down. So I'm going to start on a really high up. Okay?
Okay, yeah.
Sean, John Wick Chapter 3 got a new trailer this week. I saw it. I had watched it online like 5 times. And then it was in front of us. So I got to see it on the big screen. I don't know if I've ever been sexually attracted to a movie before, Sean. Like a movie. Not like a person in a movie. Not like a kid. No, to a movie. But when John Wick is driving down that highway on motorcycle and he takes a fucking like katana and, you know, jams it through the fucking wheel and the guy flips over. Or when he's in the giant knife store and they're promising a John Wick fight in a knife store and he's just throwing knives at a dude's head like point blank range. Oh my god, I want this movie distilled into a heroin-like substance and injected into my veins. Good god, it looks good.
It looks so fucking amazing. And for me, the best part, because we'd already seen some of the motorcycle stuff and John Wick riding the horse, which are awesome. But yeah, that the knife scene where, yeah, he's just standing in a room with like a million knives in this room. And then there's just this quick little bit in the trailer where there's a guy that's like on the ground and John Wick just throws like 3 knives, one after the other, right into the dude's chest. And like, oh my God, I forgot how good these movies are. And just like the excessive individual violence that is in, like visited upon henchmen in those movies. That's like, oh right, this is the kind of movie where John Wick like shoots every single person in the chest and then shoots them in the head. This is like, he just like throws knife after knife into this one poor fucking dude that was probably basically dead after the first knife, but he got a couple of other ones just to make sure.
I feel like this is the American equivalent of a Hong Kong action movie from the 80s.
Mm-hmm,
you know?
Absolutely.
Like a Police Story or one of the John Woo films or something like that. And we've never really had that, like with a fully like American like cast and crew, but like John Wick has done it. Chapter 3 looks even like, because I thought John Wick 1 is really good, John Wick 2 is like a big leap, it's even better, this looks like it's another leap. I can't fucking wait. May 10th I think is when it comes out. It cannot come soon enough. Oh my god, I can't even be coherent about it.
Yeah, I am extremely fucking excited for that movie.
Yeah, okay. Weird movie news. Let's just start with this. James Gunn, you might remember, writer-director of Guardians of the Galaxy 1 and 2, also known as two of the best and most successful Marvel movies, was fired from Guardians of the Galaxy 3 last year when a bunch of right-wing trolls unearthed some old tweets that were indeed very bad tweets in very bad taste that James Gunn had spent years apologizing for. And this had already been, like, known, but it became a new controversy, and Disney fired him from Guardians of the Galaxy 3. Months later, with no movement whatsoever on Guardians of the Galaxy 3 without him, with the knowledge that they were going to have to use his script anyway, or else Dave Bautista and other members of the cast had said they were going to not do it. And apparently no filmmaker in town wanting to take this movie away from James Gunn, Disney finally relented this week and said they will hire him back. He is on Guardians of the Galaxy 3. He will be writing it and directing it. The movie will be coming a little bit later than it otherwise would have, because in the meantime, WB snatched up James Gunn to do Suicide Squad 2, which we also got confirmation this week is just a full-on reboot, and he can do whatever he wants with. That made me laugh. So because of his contractual obligation to WB, Suicide Squad is coming first, and then he's doing Guardians of the Galaxy 3. I would say Disney really got played on this one, but also we're getting a James Gunn Suicide Squad movie with Idris Elba as Deadshot. So I'm like, I think we got best of both worlds out of this one, Sean.
Yes. Honestly, the most surprising part of this to me was realizing that all the shit with James Gunn only happened a year ago. When that felt like that was like a lifetime ago. It was just one of those like, oh my god, that was only one.
I'll do you
year.
One better, Sean.
That was it one happened, fucking year.
It happened in between the last Marvel movie, Ant-Man and the Wasp, and the next Marvel movie, Captain Marvel.
God,
I just
feel like that all that shit happened fucking like three lifetimes ago. What is time?
But yeah, I mean, all's well that ends well, I guess. You know, hopefully that makes it harder for this kind of stupid right-wing trolling to work in the future. You know, I'm glad that they're keeping those movies around, because I think it was becoming pretty clear just from, like, an outside observer that if he wasn't doing it, Guardians of the Galaxy 3 wasn't getting made.
Yeah, exactly.
Because those are, like, the closest Marvel has come to doing, like, really super personal movies. Maybe Black Panther also, but even then, there's, like, something about the character. Like, I think thematically Black Panther is very close to Ryan Coogler. I think all the characters feel like such personal statements in Guardians of the Galaxy, you know? No one else could write Rocket Raccoon right. You know what I mean? It's like, it wouldn't have come out right with someone else doing it. So, I'm glad. I'm also, frankly, now that DC, like, has their shit together, they've done a couple good movies in a row, you know, and James Gunn is doing Suicide Squad, and again, they traded in their old crappy Will Smith and got a shiny new Idris Elba. I'm like, good, go for it. That is trading up in the world. I will watch it. I kind of feel like best of both worlds, so, yeah.
Yes, yeah, I'm very happy to have him for Guardians 3. It would have felt just like such a missed opportunity, such a huge mistake to not have at least one more Guardians movie, because Guardians of the Galaxy 2 is a great movie, but doesn't feel like that's the last adventure for those characters on screen. And it's impossible to imagine another filmmaker doing Guardians right. So yeah, I'm really happy that he's back.
Yeah. All right. Neon Genesis Evangelion. Last year, they announced that it was coming to Netflix, the new like HD restoration. Neon Genesis is obviously a famous anime, but it had been very, very out of print in the United States for a very long time. Like, you know, hundreds of dollars on eBay out of print. This week, we got a very obnoxious announcement for the announcement of the eventual release, where they did a countdown to when they were going to announce on Twitter the release date that would be off in the future. And that's really the only reason I'm mentioning this, is because it annoys me. They did do a little trailer. It was very cool. It's coming June 24th. The footage looked beautiful. Like, clearly that show's undergone some spit and polish just behind the scenes to get it ready for HD. It's coming June 24th. They had said spring. That's not spring, but I will take it. We've waited a long time to have Evangelion, like, readily available, so I'm very excited, and we will probably do some kind of rewatch and chat on the podcast about it, I imagine, over the summer, Sean.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'll definitely watch it again once it's on Netflix. I do find it utterly fucking hilarious the way that Netflix is. It feels like they're treating Neon Genesis Evangelion like it is a new show.
And that's, I mean, effectively, like, is to a whole generation, you know?
I mean, it is a new show for a lot of people, but it's also just, I guess maybe because I have seen it, there's just this sense of, like, when I see the discussion on Twitter and stuff, it's like, people do realize the show came out, and like, it's like 20 years old. Like, yeah. I get that, like, lots of people haven't seen it. It's hard. It's, if you're trying to find a physical release, it is a hard show to watch. If you are free from such concerns, let's say, and have access to the internet, You could very easily watch Neon Genesis Evangelion should you desire.
Let me put it this way, Sean. There in the time since Neon Genesis went out of print and became easily available, streaming came into existence.
Yeah.
Crunchyroll came into existence, and the entire nature of the anime fan base in America and around the world changed pretty dramatically. And I think there's a much bigger, more connected audience to anime that obviously would like something like this, that because of the places they have grown up learning to access anime, they haven't seen it out there. So, like, it is absolutely weird to me, too, the way Netflix is treating it in some ways. But also, like, I don't think we're the audience they're pitching it to, necessarily.
That's true.
So it does make... Because, I mean, what they're doing this for is Netflix is trying to make a play to be, like, come to Netflix for anime. I think on that level it does kind of make sense to do it with a... established property, you know?
Yeah.
Like this.
I'm also very wary of the eventual bullshit discourse that's going to come out once this show is back in the popular eye and people are watching it heavily again, where people are going to be talking about how it's a deconstruction of the mecha genre in a way that's like, I just, you know, a couple of weeks ago I finished rewatching the original Mobile Suit Gundam. Neon Genesis Evangelion is not a deconstruction of mecha. Fucking Mobile Suit Gundam did that shit in 1979. I get that Neon Genesis Evangelion is much more popular over here than the original Gundam show is. But what I'm saying is Netflix should put a teaser for a teaser for a teaser for a teaser for their announcement of when they're getting Mobile Suit Gundam on their fucking... Even though you can get really nice Blu-rays of Mobile Suit Gundam like I have. The Blu-ray releases are very nice, so you can get those. But I'm just saying they should treat that with all the pomp and circumstance, because Neon Genesis Evangelion is good. It's not Gundam good, though.
Does Funimation have that on Blu-ray?
No. I think Sunrise is the production company that makes Gundam. Okay. I'm pretty sure they just handle it all in-house.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure
who... But the Blu-rays are very nice if you're looking to get those.
Because you keep telling me to watch it, and I genuinely want to watch it, so I will look
it's
into that.
Good.
All right. Moving on, Nintendo did another Nindies showcase this week. That's when they talked about indie games. A lot of cool stuff. They announced Blaster Master Zero 2, which is pretty cool. People are loving that. Cuphead is coming to Switch with Xbox Live achievements. The Stranger Things game that was announced at the Game Awards is coming. But the big announcement, and the reason why I have it on here, is that they are making a game called, well, they are not, a studio called Brace Yourself Games, the creators of Crypt of the Necro Dancer, a 2015, like, roguelike dungeon game that is also a rhythm game. They are creating, in cooperation with Nintendo, an indie game called Cadence of Hyrule, Crypt of the Necro Dancer, featuring The Legend of Zelda. So it is a Legend of Zelda-themed roguelike with like rhythm mechanics in it, and all, you know, the licensed Nintendo music. You can play as Link or Zelda. It looks fantastic. It's coming later this year. It means we're getting two Zelda games on the Switch this year, that and the Link's Awakening remake. Nintendo's never, to my knowledge at least, done anything quite like this in terms of, especially, I mean, the indie scene like it exists now has only existed for a little while, but it's a really cool move, and I hope Nintendo kind of opens up to more like this, because it seems really fun, and it seems like they're really, you know, taking the ball and running with it.
Yeah, it seems like a much better version of what they did in the 90s with Philips, when Philips was releasing the Philips CDI, and they made, like, Hotel Mario and those weird fucking Zelda games with the terrible animation, because that's the only other time I can think of. Other than, I guess they, like, licensed out Zelda for Capcom to make some of the handheld games, but even that's a little bit different.
It's a little different.
Basically Nintendo games.
I mean, yeah, they were released and published and everything by Nintendo as Nintendo exclusives. They were just produced by Capcom, you know?
Yeah, and so other than that, like, weird little footnote, the only other time they've done something like this is with Philips, and that was obviously a disaster. Because it could only ever be a disaster, because there are exactly zero good video games that ever came out on the fucking Philips CDI. So yeah, I'm excited for this. I hope that this is a sign that Nintendo is going to be more open about the use of a lot of their IP, because that would be awesome if other people could get in there and make cool new stuff with Mario and Zelda and Samus and the, like, the big stable of rich Nintendo characters. That would be pretty fucking cool.
Yeah. Also, the Capcom thing is less of a footnote than people realize. Do you know who directed Oracle of Seasons and Oracle of Ages?
I do not.
Hidemaro Fujibayashi, who later moved to Nintendo and directed Breath of the Wild.
There you go.
So, like, so he started at Capcom, got the, was, like, worked well with Nintendo. He was this young dude, came on. He actually started directing with Skyward Sword. So, like, that actually worked out really well for them. Who knows if in, like, 20 years, the Crypt of the NecroDancer people will be making, you know, the next mainline Zelda game. It's impossible to know. But yes, speaking of teases for eventual teases, fucking Atlus, biggest teases in the world. They put out a video this week with more information for Persona 5R. Let's backtrack a little bit. Persona 5R was something we knew existed from, like, website metadata hacking. Then they put out a little tease saying there is going to be a game, something related to the words Persona 5, letter R. We will tell you more about this on this date. They told us more about... No, they didn't even do that. First it was, I think, they were going to tell you something. Then they did that Persona 5 anime special. That said, we're going to tell you something on this date. We got to that date this week, Sean, and they gave a 30-second teaser for something called Persona 5 The Royal. They showed off a new character, what I assume is this game's Marie from Persona 5 or Persona 4 Golden, something like that. And they said, okay, so Persona 5 The Royal is real. And they said, more coming April 24th at the Persona P-Sound Super Live Bomb, whatever they call it.
The Persona Music Concert.
Yeah, the Persona Music Concert. And Jesus Christ, Atlus, just tell us what the fucking game is. This is obnoxious. Also, all the logos for these trailers just say PlayStation, but we all thought it was going to be a Nintendo Switch port because Joker's in fucking Smash Bros. So I don't know. Just answer our questions. I will give you my money now. Just answer the questions.
Yeah, it is... I feel like there have been, like, too many teases. Kind of like the same thing with the Evangelion thing. It's like, you can do, like, one, maybe two, but they've done, like, four. It's like, stop. You can't... Because now I don't know if April 24th is going to be the actual trailer that tells us the shit, or it's going to be another fucking tease.
I mean, we're assuming at this point it is the you know, souped-up version of Persona 5, a la Persona 4 The Golden... Persona 5 The Royal remake with all the same content plus a new social link plus some quality of life additions. That's awesome. I'm excited to play it. It's just, it's like, I, as much as I love like Persona 4 The Golden and as much as I love Persona 5, I don't need seven teases for that. If it were Persona 6, that'd be different, but that's not what this is, obviously.
Yeah. Cause if it is just a re-release, cause I would honestly like, maybe this is probably because I have played through Persona 5 twice. So I've spent about 200 hours of my life playing Persona 5. I don't think I can play a re-release of this game within a year or two.
That's fair.
I don't know if I could do that.
I've only played it once, so I'm psyched for it, but yeah.
Yeah, because obviously that depends on how much is new, because it just doesn't seem like it's going to be a whole new thing. And what is in the teaser... is it's like 30 seconds and it shows this female character with red hair that is a first year student at Shujin Academy, because you can tell from she has like the emblem or whatever that is different for which year you're at, and she's saying something about how like the Phantom Thieves, what do I think about the Phantom Thieves, oh I think you know that changing people by force isn't right, like that you know the only true change comes from within yourself, it's something to that regard, and that's basically it. And it seems like it's something that's taking place maybe near the end of when Persona 5 is happening. So all of that definitely indicates to me that it is not some like post-game, like the answer from Persona 3 Fest or something. It seems like it is, like you said, a Marie or some other sort of equivalent character that is inserted into the existing Persona 5. There's definitely space to do that with that game. I'm curious to see what that is. I just want them to tell us what this is.
Yeah. Because also Persona 5... Vanilla, we would call it now, I guess, is so wildly polished as a video game. I have trouble knowing what you would do with it. Whereas, like, Persona 3 and 4, you look back at them, and it's a little different because we did not play those the moment they came out like we did with 5, but they had real obvious gaps. Like Persona 3 had no social link with Igus when it launched.
Yeah.
Persona 4 has a lot of those, like, just a lot of the quality of life improvements more than anything on the Golden.
Yeah. But and also, there was 4 years distant because it was 2008 to 2012.
Well, which also means Persona 4 and the Golden, that was going from standard def to HD on the Vita, which I know is handheld HD, but still, like, you can't really do a major visual improvement on Persona 5. The reason this game would exist to me is the same reason Dragon Quest XI S is going to exist, which is for Switch. But these previews all have the PlayStation logo on them. Now, that does not mean it won't be on Switch. If it's not on Switch, it really doesn't make sense to me. Both because the Switch, I think I saw the number, is like... either it has outsold the PS4 total in Japan, or it's like coming up on it or something. But like, it is crazy big in Japan. Persona is crazy big in Japan. They'd be stupid not to do it, unless there's like some kind of deal with Sony that means they can't. But like... I guess I don't get the need for a Persona 5 re-release if you're not putting it on a new system. That's kind of where I'm at.
Yeah, I agree. Especially with it feeling so soon. But, you know, we'll see what this is. What I want more than anything else is I want Persona 5 Arena. I want Arc System Works to have a really gorgeous-looking Persona fighting game with a big story mode that has crossovers with the three games. That's what I want.
Speaking of Arc System Works, Sean, according to V-Jump in Japan, the next character for Dragon Ball FighterZ for DLC past Season 2 is Son Goku from Dragon Ball GT, which means it's Kid Goku, but you get the blue gi, you still get Nioibo, the power pole, but he can go Super Saiyan 3 and do a Kamehameha, and he has what they're calling the Super Ultra Genki Dama. I like this. I think this is a fun solution to doing a new Goku because you get best of both worlds. You get Kid Goku, but you get to do the GT version, which has a lot of stylistic things. There's a lot of Easter eggs they could put in there from what they've shown already. There's a lot of creative stuff. I think this is the right solution for doing a kid version of Goku. I like it a lot.
I can envision like four possible Gokus that they could do. There are more Gokus they could do. Four realistic possibilities for Gokus. There's Ultra Instinct Goku, which is what I hypothesized, which definitely does not seem to be the case if this is going to be the next character. There's Super Saiyan 4 GT Goku, or there's original Dragon Ball Goku, or there's this GT Kid Goku. Of those four possibilities, I honestly think this is the one I would least want. Because at least Super Saiyan 4 Goku is like crazy and weird and dumb looking. And I just want original Dragon Ball Kid Goku. I want fucking like Jonkin Fist. I want like weird Goku stuff. I want to like headbutt through somebody like he does to King Piccolo. Like I would rather have that Goku than Super Saiyan 3 Kid Goku. I don't like how he looks.
That's fair. I think it's also possible they will win you over when it comes out in the game.
Oh, sure. Like, I'm definitely going to play this, and, like, yeah. I want new characters, and I'm happy to have new characters. I'm just saying I would rather have a Kid Goku, the original Kid Goku, or Ultra Instinct Goku would have been my two primary choices.
Yeah, I totally get that. For me, I mean, one, they've done nothing from GT yet, right?
No GT stuff in the game at all.
And I know people like to say, like, oh, but GT's been decanonized. No, there's no fucking Dragon Ball canon that, like, they take things out or into. It's there if you fucking want it. And there is cool stuff.
Yeah, like, Cooler and Movie Broly are in the game. Like, there are, quote-unquote, non-canon characters. Yeah. It doesn't matter. They should put GT stuff in the game eventually, for sure.
Yeah, and I think, like I said, it kind of feels like they're getting a couple birds with one stone. I very much wanted a Kid Goku when I listed, like, my preferences earlier, so... And I get what you're saying, like, because there's stuff from early Dragon Ball they could do that they probably won't hear, but you know, I'm interested in it. It's not what I was expecting, so it was an interesting surprise. I am very curious what they would do with some of those others you mentioned, like Ultra Instinct Goku, but I also wonder like if Ultra Instinct Goku would feel a little too much like some of the very technical characters they already have in the game. There's not a lot of very small characters. I really like some of the smaller ones, like Krillin in there is really interesting. So I don't know. I'm curious. This means there's only one we don't know.
Yeah.
Because they already announced they're doing new movie Broly, and new movie Gogeta Blue. And you had predicted the other two were Kefla and Ultra Instinct Goku. I thought you were right on the money on that. Now it seems like, okay, we're not getting Ultra Instinct Goku now, at least. We could in a Season 3, hypothetically. Would they do Kefla and GT Goku? I don't know. Who is the other one? Who is the pair with GT Goku? Because they're not heavily themed, but they usually do villain-hero. So...
Yeah. So I think Kefla is still definitely a possibility, especially considering that it was Jiren and Videl before, which are, like, totally disconnected characters from, like, different series. So I think it's entirely possible that we get a GT and Super character. Because while I am fine with having GT Kid Goku, I don't particularly want like Baby Vegeta or Super Android 7. You know, like Omega Shenron is the only GT villain I think is fine. I will accept an Omega Shenron. Fair enough.
I just had an idea, and now I'm mad because it's never happening. But I wanted Pan and Jiru, the little
yeah
robot.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I would like to have a Pan, but we're definitely. Pan is not going to be the other character. Pan would be cool.
Baby Pan. That's how they could do it. Pan does get taken over by Baby.
Does she? I don't even remember that part. I rewatched GT, that part of GT, not that long ago, because I got through that part and then gave up shortly after. My money is still on Kefla. I don't think that this not being Ultra Instinct Goku puts her out, because I do think that they probably also just want to have another female character, because they got Videl in. There's just not very many female fighting characters in the Dragon Ball franchise, so I think it would be smart of them to go for Kefla.
Young Chi Chi,
that's a possibility. In Dragon Ball Legends, they put in Young Chi Chi. She's from the original Dragon Ball tournament. It's possible.
Chi-Chi's got the, like, hat that shoots the laser.
That young Chi-Chi.
No, I mean young Chi-Chi, like Pat Chi-Chi.
Yeah, I thought you meant Chi-Chi when she fights Goku at the tournament, Chi-Chi that has a, like, razor boomerang on her helmet and, shoots a beam from a jewel in her forehead.
That's what I want. I'm going deep cut on this.
It's like the character who can least fly in Dragon Ball but still fights in the series, Young Chi-Chi.
Or, I mean, God, there's so many they could do. I still want them to do something with Master Roshi, and, like, the turtle could come in and help him fly. That's what the turtle would do. Yeah. There's so many things you could do. Or Kintoan, because Kintoan is not in the game except in an animation for base Goku.
But Roshi can't fly on the Kintoan because he's a dirty pervert.
That would be a move, if you execute a move wrong, Kintoan comes in and he falls through.
Yeah, instead of the turtle, Kintoan comes in and, he falls straight through it. Yeah, that would be pretty good.
Anyway.
I think they should put in the carrot boss who turns to the rabbit that turns people into carrots. I think, and he only has one attack, all the buttons do the same thing, and it's just if it connects, it turns you into a carrot and he automatically wins. That's what I want.
But however he loses, he gets sent to the moon.
Yes, yeah, that's always the losing screen, is him pounding Mochi on the moon with his henchmen. Yeah.
All right. Yeah, the more we talk about Dragon Ball FighterZ, the more I want to play Dragon Ball FighterZ. Dragon Ball Heroes is coming out on Switch in a little bit, early April. And I still...
Oh, shit, yeah, that is soon.
I probably am going to get that because I need the life experience of playing Dragon Ball Heroes. So anyway.
Yeah, I need to know what that game is.
All right, moving on. Our last pieces of news are the big pieces of news this week. This is like mini topics I want to go over. First off, Sean, Google finally announced their gaming platform. It is Project Stadia. And Stadia is an entirely streaming platform. You can do it on your PC, your Mac, anything like that. You just have to have Chrome, I think. You can also do it on TV via Chromecast, which is like their Apple TV Roku competitor. But if you're going to do that, you have to have a new controller they've made. It looks kind of like the Xbox controller and the PlayStation controller had a baby. You know, that's basically what it looks like. This is Project Stadia. It will be expanding to other platforms in the future. They're hoping to get in a lot of places. They have a lot of integration with YouTube and with streaming services. One thing they pitched is, like, if you're watching someone streaming a game, you could buy the game and jump into a play session with the streamer or at the place the streamer was. If they were at Lair of the Shadow Broker in Mass Effect 2, it would unlock and you could just go to Lair of the Shadow Broker or something, I guess. They didn't use that as an example. I'm just trying to think of something.
That would have been a very weird example to pull out. Is remember Lair of the Shadow Broker? That was a really rad piece of DLC. What if you could just jump into it with your favorite streamer?
It tells you how much I like Mass Effect 2 that I thought, what's a good game moment? And I went, there you go. That
Lair of the Shadow Broker.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely, it's a good game moment. All right, anyway. That's Project Stadia. The only hardware they're releasing for it is that controller, which looks like a perfectly serviceable controller. Again, this is all streaming, so the idea is they can... So let's give them the upsell of what they're trying to say. The upside is because they're running it all on their in-house PCs and servers, they could give you a really good experience that is better than what consoles would give, because consoles are locked to the hardware in the box. This would be... they can throw whatever hardware they want at it. Maybe they could even, they're even saying at best internet speeds, we could get you 4K, 60 FPS, and then they just stream the video signal, the challenge being latency times, the challenging being bandwidth, but if it works well enough, and they're pitching that, like, they've made it work very well, they did that Assassin's Creed Odyssey thing that was the beta for this, the big beta test for this. So the idea being, if you have, like, a 15 megabit per second up internet connection, that you could get, you know, pretty good video and audio from it that challenges current consoles. And of course, you do not have to install, you do not have to have a hard drive, you do not have to own a console, any of that. That definitely does sound good in, like, the future. My refutation of that, Sean, will be I was in the Assassin's Creed Odyssey beta.
Mm-hmm.
I have the internet speed they recommended. It didn't work. Just didn't. It stuttered. It kept switching resolutions. The latency was very noticeable. People did demo it this week with Google, and some of it was pretty good, but I also heard from people saying the latency was so off, even in their, like, internal testing, that, like, it was hard to play some of the games. So, I mean, my view on streaming is where it has been for a while with video games, which is that sounds great if you work in the Google offices where you have really good fiber internet, and it sounds pretty bad for most of America, which is a country that has notoriously bad internet speeds. So I don't know.
Yeah, so there is a lot here because this was at GDC, so yes. They had like an hour-long presentation. I think that is important context because there's like kind of two things going on here with Google. One is that, like, quite literally this was a presentation for video game developers. The audience was full of video game developers. It was at the Video Game Developer Conference, GDC. So like that is a big part of their audience was specifically a pitch to developers. But the way it was structured and messaged and, like, they were clearly... And, you know, they live-streamed it to the world. Like, it was also designed as an announcement for the rest of the world, too. Which I thought was an interesting way to do it. Instead of just having, like, a couple of weeks before GDC have their announcement live-stream that was more for the public and saying, this is what this thing is. And then having a more in-depth thing specifically aimed at developers at GDC. I think that probably would have been a better strategy because... Jonathan, did you watch the whole,
no.
like, 50-minute thing? Okay, yeah. So I watched...
I read a lot of articles about it. I did not watch the video.
Yeah. So I watched it, and it was just sort of interesting because it felt like they were constantly having to kind of play two games, and because they were having to play two games at once, not, like, literal video games, but, like sort of dance two dances at once with, like, the message they were trying to convey, they couldn't kind of do each one as optimally as they otherwise could. So that's just sort of like the top level thing. And to get another very petty thing out of the way before we start talking about the substance, I think the name is fucking terrible. The name is so bad. It's impossible to remember.
It's the plural for stadium, which is such a weird esoteric thing. Like, you could have just called it Google Stadium and we would have gotten it, but they had to go
Google
Stadium and be all esoteric on us. I don't get it.
Yeah, it's the Latin plural for the word stadium. It's just like, fuck off. The plural for stadium is stadiums, goddammit. Nobody speaks Latin anymore. It's an academic language. Stop it. You could have called it Google Games, Google Stadium, fucking whatever. Google Stadia. Like, what the fuck? It sounds like the fucking writing team for the most recent season of Doctor Who named it. It's like, just like... No, this isn't how you name shit. It's impossible to remember this goddamn name. It's not the Subuki. It's not the Battle of Blagadugbe. Like, name it something that someone can fucking remember.
Well, you know, I actually think it does signal one of the issues that I'm sure you're going to bring up. Like, you mentioned they're kind of playing to two audiences at that presentation. Stadia sounds like an internal development thing that you share with developers. It does not sound like a forward-facing, like a consumer-facing brand. Like, as stupid as Xbox One X is... Xbox, what were they calling it? Project...
Scorpio.
That's cooler, but, like, that's still very clearly an internal development thing, right? It doesn't sound like they've gone through the process of, like, figuring out an actual thing for consumers. And I do think the entire project feels like it exists in a weird space between... This is for... We're trying to figure out stuff for the far-off future of games. This is internal R&D. And also, we're selling this to people. And I don't think they've figured out what side of that line they're on. So, yeah.
And I think the other thing that just kind of bugs me about the Stadia name and why it just seems bad and dumb to me is, like, the pitch for streaming for video games should be, like, anybody can play these games. And it's like, and you don't have to buy a $400 or $500 box that sits under your TV to play these video games. Like, everything you own, your phone, your laptop, your tablet, and probably your smart TV, or if you don't have a smart TV, you can buy a $10 little widget or whatever, plug into your TV, and as long as you have a controller, which we will offer, or it will use basically any modern video game controller, as long as it can sync up to whatever device it is, you will be able to play these games. That's the pitch, is video games for the broad masses. The name Stadia sounds like such a fucking highbrow, like, snooty-tooty fucking name. It doesn't sound like the, you know, I'm going to boot up the Stadia program or whatever and play Assassin's Creed. It sounds like you should be, like, you know, holding up your pinky whenever you say it. It's just a dumb, bad name. I don't get why they picked it.
It would be like if they gave Gmail some weird esoteric name, you know?
Exactly.
Like they have, you know, Google Mail, they have Google Music, they have Google, you know, apps, all of these kinds of things. If it were just Google Games, it would slot in there, because that's where they want this to go eventually, right? It's like it's just part of the Google service.
Exactly.
Google Stadia is going to stand out like a sore fucking thumb next to their other products that they have and we use every day. Like, they don't call Google Drive, you know, Google Space Comet, or what, I don't know what it would be.
Yeah, they don't call Gmail, like, Google Digital Epistolary. Like, it's fucking, like, you just, and that's what the Stadia name sounds like, right?
It's G-Pistolary. That's
exactly.
Gmail G-Pistolary.
G-Pistolary. It's fucking dumb. So, anyways, moving on from, you know, what is a broadly trivial thing, but it's still fucking dumb, from their name to the actual pitch. Like, the first thing I want to point out is, it's just, again, like, a big part of, because I overall do not like this pitch and did not like what they were saying. And a big part of it was Google as a company I have very mixed feelings about, especially some of, like, the streamer stuff in the YouTube integration. When, like, for context, this was a couple of days after the Christchurch shooting happened, where someone in New Zealand shot and killed 50 people and injured about 50 others. And during that live, he live streamed it. And during that live stream, he as a kind of calling card, he said, subscribe to PewDiePie, because that's become an alt-right sort of message, or like firebrand on the internet, is subscribe to PewDiePie. So I wasn't super fucking hyped about, like, the gaming culture on YouTube when I started watching this fucking thing. So I just thought it was maybe
a
little bit.
And we should also
say,
YouTube has done zero substantive to address the problems that created the conditions for that shooter to do that. Like YouTube and Google have to answer for things after that, and they have made no effort to answer for that. And doing this in the course of not answering for that is extra tone deaf.
Yeah, and the whole presentation was so geared towards, like, this is, like, our YouTube streamer. Like, all the, like, videos that they showed had, like, were clips from different people streaming games and stuff and, like, commenting over them. And they were really heavily leaning into that integration. So that part just, like, kind of rubbed me the wrong way fucking immediately, and them not addressing anything about, like, and we're going to, like, work to improve, you know, our moderation of the culture of on YouTube of video game streams and, like, you know, and do that kind of stuff. They didn't address any of that at all. And so that really frustrated me. Other stuff that frustrated me was, and there was a really good, I wish I could remember who it was, but there was a really good game developer that was probably in the audience that did a whole tweet thread while this was going on, sort of making fun of Google's attitude, because the way that Google presented every single thing in the presentation was like they had invented it, when, like, OnLive was a service that existed in, like, 2009, I think, OnLive started. Like, PS Now has been ongoing for, like, 8 or 9 fucking years at this point. Video game streaming, while it is not, like, those services were not slash are not good, it has existed. It's just, like, the basic concept of all this stuff has been around for a decade plus at this point. And Google going up there and acting like they've invented every single thing about the idea of streaming a video game as opposed to owning the hardware is, again, just, like, really fucking annoying. Especially when it's, again, presumed this is a GDC conference, like the people here know what fucking streaming video games is. It's been going on for a while. A lot of them have probably had to program something for, like, PS Now or something to get, like, their PS3 game to work right with that or some shit. Like, it's like those basic concepts are not new. The new stuff that Google is doing is stuff with, like, the controller can connect Wi-Fi to the servers directly to cut down from the latency. That's a cool fucking idea. So it's like the controller knows what game you're playing. It connects to the server directly. So both your, let's say your laptop is where you're playing your game. Your laptop connects to the Google server. The controller connects to the Google server. And so instead of your controller having to communicate to your laptop, which then communicates the inputs to the server, the controller communicates the inputs to the server directly, which then are reflected on the video that comes back. That's a smart improvement. Stuff of like, even if I don't like that they didn't address the culture stuff, the YouTube integration and the way that that works, that's a new idea. That's something new that, like, you know, Google seems to be the first people doing that in this space. But stuff of like, oh, we own the hardware, so we can make all these really nice PCs or whatever that can run the hardware, and we can, based on the demands of the individual video game, we can give you access to more resources, so we can spin off like multiple different shards or whatever from our server to work specifically for your game. If it's some crazy like 1,000-person multiplayer game that they were talking about, they're like, oh, like these other games that would be possible with streaming because of our access to the technology that would not be possible otherwise. Well, none of the like experiments in that space were ever successful. They have existed, and OnLive was doing stuff with that. So again, like, those ideas Google has not invented. They've been in the space for a long time. And so, like, there's a certain tone of arrogance about their presentation that I found very fucking obnoxious. That probably would not be communicated from, like, reading articles about it. But when you sit and watch a 50-minute video of them talking about this shit, it's like, yo, you guys didn't... I get it. You're Google. You're a big company. You guys didn't invent any of this shit. You have not been a member of this, like, space in video games before. We have been doing this already. Like, it would have been nice for them to have had a slightly different attitude about that. And then otherwise, the main takeaway is probably like what you were saying, of that the proof is in the pudding, and they didn't do much to show or really argue for that this would be a product for the masses. Like, they honestly didn't feel like they were like spinning the argument for like, and it doesn't matter. Like, they weren't trying to say like, it doesn't matter if you live in the middle of Iowa or you live in Silicon Valley, like, you know, Google's gonna work for you whatever, however way, like with like how our data centers and all that shit. It didn't feel like they were trying to make that specific pitch, which was to me this pitch that they really needed to make. Because this thing is only works if it works, and I have no confidence that it's going to work for me. And it would have been nice for them to at least try to make that pitch and try to make that argument.
I'll break it down nice and simple. The upside for Google Stadia is getting people who don't currently play games because of the upfront costs associated with consoles and the like into playing games, right?
Yeah.
That group of people, because the other group, which is pre-existing gamers who own a PS4 or Xbox One, probably would prefer to stick with their PS4 or Xbox One, right?
Yes.
Okay, so we've got that established. So if you're going for that group of people, you can't ask that group of people to be thinking about their internet speeds and checking that. Do you know what I mean? Like,
mm-hmm.
like generally, like there's a tech savviness that comes with that that a lot of people aren't going to have. If to watch Netflix, you had to be very conscious about what internet plan you bought at your point of service with Comcast or whatever company sells you internet. It's Mediacom for me in Iowa. Netflix would not be popular. Like Netflix got to the point... Like, there was Netflix streaming years before Netflix streaming took off, right? But yeah. Back then, it was something where it didn't necessarily work all the time, or you had to think about it, or they severely limited the number of hours you could spend streaming because they didn't have the server capacity. Now you're at a point where streaming video is big because if you have internet, you can probably do streaming video. I know that's not true for everyone. There are some very rural parts of the country that still run on like pretty crappy DSL. But in general, for the majority of people, if you have internet, even if you have a signal on your phone, right, like you can watch some Netflix. That is not true of game streaming. Game streaming probably is the future someday. I don't know if it is because I don't know how we get there under current circumstances without like an Eisenhower-esque push for, you know, internet connectivity across the country, similar to Eisenhower's push for like the interstate system. And that's never happening in current political environment. So... maybe it is the future, but it has to be that simple to take off. It has to be that accessible to take off. I don't think it's that accessible yet. You know, I know people make jokes about Iowa. People do actually live in Iowa. Iowa City is not like some small hick town. I am paying for basically the best internet money can buy in this city because there's not a ton of options. I could raise my bandwidth cap and stuff, but I don't need to. You know, I'm one person and a roommate. So, like, you know, I'm doing that. And again, their beta didn't work. So, like, it has to work for the person in Iowa City or Detroit or Austin, Texas or something. You know, like just it has to work in places beyond Silicon Valley. And I just don't see that happening. And what that leads to is Google is a company well known for starting like little experiments and then when they don't take off, dropping it. And I think everyone right now is rushing headlong into this project of streaming, thinking like someone's going to crack it and we don't want to be the person left behind, without anybody realizing that like why it's not happening is just because of current technological considerations throughout the country. You're not going to be the first one there right now, whoever you are, I don't think. So maybe put your innovations into, you know, something that's actually going to sell. Like, you know, like the Nintendo Switch is an actual innovation in the gaming space that brings new people in because you don't have to have a certain, like, you know, note on your internet connection to play it. So, like, that's kind of my thought right now on all of this. And so I don't even think, you know, I don't even know if it's worth, like, talking about it this long because I don't think it's going to really go anywhere.
Yeah, it is the first concentrated pitch we've actually had for like a new one of these services that is not PS Now, which is like old and dusty and it just has never seemed particularly good. A couple of like last things about Stadia is I thought it was weird that they just didn't talk about pricing at all. And so it's like I have no concept of, is it a subscription thing? Do you just buy games and like I pay $60 for Assassin's Creed Odyssey and I just own that for as long as Google Stadia is a thing? Or do I, you know, is it something that like PS Now works like as a rental thing predominantly? So it's like, do I pay like here's like, or is it an option to pay like a 1 month rental on Assassin's Creed Odyssey or whatever? Like there's no discussion of that at all. Like no, nothing. So I have no idea if it's a Netflix of gaming kind of thing of we have a wide selection of games available to you that you will be able to access through a subscription. It's something that you buy piecemeal and they're going to be full priced. It's like DLC, any of like microtransactions, like that kind of stuff. Like the nitty gritty wasn't there, which is one of those things that felt like, well, you know, if you're showing this at GDC, I would have liked a little bit more of that nitty gritty. The other thing was they did bring out Jade Raymond, who's well-known in the gaming space for being, I forget what her title was, but she was really high up and really heavily involved in the early Assassin's Creed games, particularly Assassin's Creed 1. So she worked with Ubisoft. Ubisoft, very prominent there. Yves Guillemot was in the audience. They, like, cut to him in the audience temporarily, be like, look, we have someone from video games. And I was reminded, like, right, Ubisoft is always there day one, whatever, like, whatever the fuck it is, Ubisoft is up for it. They'll put their video games on fucking anything. Yves Guillemot will be there in the audience, and you can do whatever you want with fucking Ubisoft stuff. So Ubisoft was there, and the Jade Raymond, who used to work at Ubisoft, is now the head of, I don't remember what the name is, but basically, like, Google Stadia developer group. Like, if there's some sort of, like, in-house first-party development group for Google. So they have that. They have people making games, presumably that are going to be exclusive on Google Stadia, but they didn't have anything to show from it. They didn't have like a logo, like a title card for a game, like nothing like that. So it seemed like that side of it was super early, which is another part of the pitch that felt very lacking. Was if you really wanted to prove that, oh, we are going to be able to make games available on Google Stadia that simply could not exist on like conventional hardware, then you have to, if you're going to make that pitch, you have to actually make the pitch and not just tell me that that's something that could be done and show me that being done. I didn't like that they just had like an executive on stage saying, imagine the possibilities of you could have, you know, a battle royale game with 1,000 people instead of 100 because of whatever, you know, because if we have access to all the servers that we could get to use this and it doesn't have to rely on individual consumer hardware. It's like, okay, well, that's nice for you to just say, imagine that. You're the fucking, like, multi-billion-dollar company. Show it to me. Prove to me that you can do that. Until you can do that, I don't kind of give a shit. So, like, a lot of that stuff about the pitch just felt, like, half done to me in a way that I was honestly surprised by.
Honestly, I think if somebody pulls this off in the near future, the streaming thing, it's going to be Xbox. I really believe that, because I think, like, it's kind of an open secret that, I mean, we know they're working on streaming. It's an open secret that the idea would be to stream Game Pass out, right? And they have spent time building that library, building all the backwards compatibility stuff. They would be able to launch day one with a very clear service model. You pay $9.99 a month or whatever for annual. You get Xbox Game Pass. That is a bunch of great games from three generations of Xbox. People know what Xbox means. They know to expect games from it. And it would be easy to understand and accessible and have that business model. Like, that, I think, is what would sell this. You know, like, I think PlayStation probably could if they gave a shit about PS Now, but that very clearly was, like, something they sent out to die back in 2013 when they launched the PS4 and then have not talked about it since, you know? It's there, you can use it if you want, they don't mention it. So yeah, I think that's the kind of thing that could work. So we'll see. Who knows?
Yeah, I think with Xbox, the thing that will be nice is that it, kind of like with PS Now, it'll be supplementing an already existing business model that they are already, we know they're committed to this space. And that's maybe the number one thing with Google, like you're saying, that we know that Google will try out some weird experiment and then drop it as soon as it's not like as successful as they want it to be. And since Google doesn't already have a stake in this space, there is very little reason for them to be committed past, like, if it is rough goings early on, they don't need to be committed through those rough goings, whereas Sony and Microsoft are already committed to the space. They're not going to pull out. It'll be a supplement to the, like, conventional stuff that is ongoing, and that is reliable to me in a way that even if it's a kind of service that, because of internet stuff, maybe I would not be able to take advantage of, it's fine that it exists. With Google Stadia, it feels like I'm not convinced they're going into this, like, with the best intentions and, like, with the clearest sort of head about how to go about it in the video game space. And I'm concerned about it being, like, weirdly disruptive and them just, like, kind of throwing their weight around early on and making all this, like, bullshit. And these, like, in games, they're going to end up making games that if the service doesn't take off and they close it down, eventually will die and be gone forever because nobody will own it in any way. It will only exist on their servers. So that kind of stuff is stuff that I very much wish that if they were going to make this pitch now, they would have come at it again, like, more fully considered instead of doing this weird hour-long presentation at GDC that didn't feel like it was fully directed at a mass audience, nor did it feel fully prepared for, like, the nitty-gritty details you'd expect for the presentation for the developers there.
All right. Let's go ahead and move on to our final piece of news for today, which is that Disney formally closed their $71 billion acquisition of 20th Century Fox. Fox is now part of Disney. Fox is no more. All your movies are belong to Disney. A little bit of irony, Sean. Let me see if I can remember my film history for a moment. Fox started its life in the 1930s, I believe. It was not one of the original Big Six studios. It was I don't think it quite started out on Poverty Row, which was the name for, like, real B-list studios, but it was, like, one of the other five. Fox got bigger after the Paramount Decree of 1948, which is the famous decree that broke up the studios because the studios were vertically integrated. They owned the theaters, they owned the exposition spaces, and they obviously were making the movies. They broke that up. That gave players like Fox more of an opening, and you had more studio diversity for a little while because of that. Now we're on the other end, and all the studios are becoming worse monopolies than they ever were before the Paramount Decree. And now Disney owns Fox. Fox is dead. Let's go over a little bit of the casualties, Sean. Immediately layoffs happened. The first thing was that Disney shut down the Fox 2000 label. This is a division of Fox run by a woman named Elizabeth Gabler. They made such films as Hidden Figures, The Fault in Our Stars, The Devil Wears Prada, Marley and Me, Love, Simon, and The Hate U Give. Some of those definitely very impactful, successful, and acclaimed movies over the years that probably would not have been made elsewhere. Layoffs began en masse. Analysts estimate 3,000 total layoffs at present, but no exact numbers yet. This is an excerpt from Variety. The axe fell at the film division with brutal efficiency, wiping away much of the senior leadership at Fox's marketing, distribution, and consumer products arms. Some staffers who had been engaging in gallows humor for weeks burst into tears when they received the word in one-on-one meetings with human resource reps that their positions were being terminated. And lest you think, oh, well, I really hope Disney does a good job with Fox's giant catalog of important movies that I might like to see more home video stuff from, because Fox has done pretty good with their home video over the years. The digital bits, the best and like longest standing website on just basically physical media on the internet, they've been around forever, they have a lot of sources. They wrote, longtime Fox home entertainment chief Mike Dunn, Fox innovation lab leader Danny Kaye, and Fox's chief technology officer Hanno Basse all laid off this week. Dunn saw Fox through the HD format war, that's HD DVD Blu-ray, and Kaye and Basse have been key figures in not just Blu-ray but 4K Ultra HD, ensuring the highest quality possible for the format. Sadly, that's just the start. I've recently spoken with other people I know there at the studio, and they're all looking at a very uncertain future and likely layoffs. So, it's easy to make the jokes. It's easy to, you know, slide into feeling like, oh, cool, we're going to get X-Men in the MCU or something stupid like that. But one of the most significant studios in American history just got taken out. I think the Fox 2000 label makes it, which, by the way, Disney had promised not to shut Fox 2000 down. They lied about that. I think Fox Searchlight is probably on the chopping block. What is going to happen because of this is not Disney making a bunch of new movies and trying to be an awards player and suddenly funding independent cinema or stuff like that. What Disney did, Disney spent that $71 billion to take a player off the chessboard. They did it to get rid of competition. And I don't think you are going to see more movies from Disney. I don't think you are going to see more like adult style fare like a Hidden Figures that Disney does not and has not made for decades now. This is going to be a significant blow to American cinema. There is no way around it.
Yeah, no. I mean, it is what it seemed like it was going to be. Right?
Yeah,
that seems to be where we are in, like, the worst possible version of this acquisition, but, like, it seemed like the inevitable version of it, which is, as you were saying, Disney is not doing this out of some sort of desire to make American movies better or something, or do right by this new catalog. As you're saying, they're doing it to be the most, like, brutally efficient company they can be, and the most brutally efficient company you can be is to eliminate your competition so that more people go to see the output you are already making rather than increasing the output and diversifying your output. As long as Disney is making the fucking like dozen plus movies that you highlighted in our like beginning of the year podcast when you went through all the movies they're making and all the money that they might make from it. I mean, it doesn't even like they kind of can't put more money or put more movies on the calendar because they would literally just be replacing their own competition with themselves and destroying themselves in some weird way. And so instead of competing with Fox, if they're putting out all the movies that Fox would be making, they would just be destroying the movies that they're already making. They just want those movies to make $2 billion regularly instead of $1 billion regularly, you know?
Yeah, I mean, Disney's strategy right now is pretty transparently to me to take out literally all existing competition in the tentpole movie space. Like, that is where they're headed. I'm not sure. Like, Fox was not their biggest competitor, but it also wasn't their smallest. And I really do wonder how Paramount, Universal, and WB, being the other major players, survive. You know, and maybe the space just gets filled in because to survive, those studios are going to have to make smaller stuff and have, you know, much higher profit margins probably, but smaller profits overall. Something like an Us, which is a Universal release, like Universal's biggest hits lately have been things like that, that Disney does not make. But I don't know. I think it's a dark thing. We have a lot of problems in America where companies have gotten too big and we desperately need to start enforcing the antitrust laws we have on the books because they are just too big. But, I don't know. It's just, when you put out all the facts, it's just depressing.
Yeah, and like between this and like if you imagine the scenario where Google Stadia becomes extremely successful and the damage that that would do to the video game space, like the combination of those two things is like, it, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I don't think I talked about this on the podcast, but a couple of weeks ago I rewatched RoboCop. Great fucking movie. Good movie to watch in this atmosphere with like mega corporations going at each other being like, when is Disney going to literally buy the police force? In the next 10 years, it's possible. Like, when is the fucking cop going to show up at your door with a fucking Mickey Mouse badge? That's kind of what it feels like, is we're going down this road where these mega corporations are just kind of buying up everything they can in the sectors they exist in. And then once Disney fills up the whole movie bucket, where do they then move on to?
I don't know. Here are some things that Disney now owns. These properties, Sean, are now Disney. The Simpsons.
Ugh.
Avatar. Planet of the Apes is Disney now. Independence Day. Ridley Scott's Alien.
Fuck.
Die Hard. Ice Age. Alvin and the Chipmunks. The Borat movie, just for fun. That's weird to me. Borat is a Disney character now. And the film rights to Assassin's Creed. Of course, they also own the entire Fox Searchlight catalog, so if they wanted to, they could make a Kingdom Hearts game with characters from Black Swan, Juno, The Shape of Water. I would love to have Roxas meet the fish-fucking guy. Slumdog Millionaire, The Grand Budapest Hotel, and last year Oscar winner, The Favourite.
You know, I think it's going to be really bold when Kingdom Hearts 4 tackles teen pregnancy and their crossover with Juno. You know, it's going to be a big one.
All right. Sean, you want to move on to a couple pieces of listener mail before we talk about us?
Yes, let's move away from our dark corporate future.
All right.
And talk about our listeners.
I'll just hit these three really quick. First off, Kenny. Kenny asked, I don't remember if you've discussed this already, Doctor Who, Tom Baker, Season 7 on Blu-ray? We did talk about that, Kenny. I think it was at the end of last year when they announced that. And just to recap, on the one hand, it's really cool they're doing Doctor Who box sets on Blu-ray. They've done Tom Baker Season 1, Peter Davison Season 1, and now Tom Baker Season 7. I have the Tom Baker Season 1 set. It's fantastic. It is probably the single most thorough release for a TV show I have ever seen in box set form. It's very slapdash right now because they've done two first seasons of Doctors and then the final season, and a fairly rocky final season of that, of the same Doctor, Tom Baker. And there does not seem to be a ton of rhyme or reason to it yet, but, you know, if they can hopefully sell enough to make this a regular thing, it would be awesome. Makes me feel a little better about Doctor Who after the show got the creative shit kicked out of it last year. So, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, if you want to go watch Megalos in, you know, beautiful HD, you can do that with the Season 7 Tom Baker collection.
Well, you really can't because it was shot on video, so it'll look a little better than DVD. Really, the appeal of the Blu-ray sets is getting everything in one place because they've put all the bonus features together. You don't have to buy five different box sets to get five serials because they used to sell them very piecemeal. Megalos, I'm sorry, is never going to look particularly beautiful.
Well, you know, that's probably appropriate for the way that Megalos looks will reflect the quality of Megalos as a TV story. Fucking Megalos. I need to rewatch that last Tom Baker season, so I should probably pick up that Blu-ray because it is so bizarre and peculiar. But we talked about it all on near the end of last year when it was, because I think that was when the trailer originally came out. So people can probably find that date.
Because it's Tom Baker narrating and it's amazing.
Yes, the trailer is very good.
All right. Barry asks, any impressions of the Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines 2 trailer or exposure to the franchise? I have to say, Barry, I was putting together notes for your second question, and I forgot to look this up. I don't know what this is.
Okay, so I have not seen the trailer. I have seen screen caps of the trailer for Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines 2. And I have played through, this is a long time ago. I played it probably about halfway through the original Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines. Vampire the Masquerade, sans the Bloodlines part, but just Vampire the Masquerade is a, tabletop role-playing game franchise came out, I think, in, the late 90s. It's very, Anne Rice-style vampire, cults in, long lines of ancient vampire clans and that kind of stuff. And then in the early 2000s, I forget the company, but some company made a PC RPG based on that franchise called Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines. It's a big cult classic. It's a really interesting game that has a lot of really expressive RPG mechanics. It's a very unique kind of RPG. If you do want to go back and play it, you need to kind of mod it up a little bit because it's one of those games that's really cool, but when it first released, it was utterly fucking broken, kind of like a KOTOR 2 or a Fallout New Vegas kind of thing. So if you want to play, you should look up some mods. I remember it being very cool. I don't remember that much about it. I obviously didn't finish it. I think probably because I think I hit some sort of save bug or something that prevented me from finishing it. But I remember there being a very cool haunted house level. And I am down for a new like cool RPG that is not just like sci-fi or fantasy. So having something like kind of horror based in with the vampire stuff, I'm down for that. I haven't seen the trailer, so I don't know if that looks good or not. But the idea of a spiritual successor, a sequel to Vampire the Masquerade Bloodlines, is exciting to me.
Excellent. He also asked about Sekiro. You already talked about that. He did say the stealth in Sekiro has made me really consider going back and playing the first season of Hitman I slept on. Sean, do you have thoughts on whether or not people should play Hitman?
People should go back and play Hitman, and good pointing out that so Sekiro does have some cool stealth mechanics, and that's a big thing about if you have started playing that game and you're just playing it like Dark Souls and just running up and attacking head-on every enemy you run into, you are playing Sekiro wrong. Try to like get the drop on enemies and stuff, because that was a big adjustment I had to make. But yes, Sekiro is cool. Hitman 1 is even cooler.
All right. He also asked, did you see the Criterion channel announce their initial catalog? Anything you recommend or are looking forward to watching? Why, yes. Criterion channel, I am a charter subscriber, which so far just means I gave them my email address, and when the service launches, they will sign me up for the service at like a lower rate. So if you haven't done that yet and you want the Criterion channel, do it now because you'll get it for a couple bucks less a month going forward, which is cool. And then they've been streaming a movie a week that they're going to have. But it is launching in April. Criterion Gate went over what the lineup will be. It's pretty much what you would expect. It's the entire Janus Films collection. Janus Films is a company that is basically Criterion's partner company or parent company. Janus, it goes back to like the 60s when they started like putting out Kurosawa stuff in the US. Janus basically owns international art house cinema roughly, like for the United States. Like they have everything by Kurosawa, they have everything by Ozu, they have everything by Bergman, they have everything by Renoir, or you know, whoever you want to go to. Like they have all of that stuff. So most of the Criterion collection is Janus Films, so that means most of what they have on disc will be on there. Plus Janus has a lot of stuff like Godzilla they acquired a couple years ago. They have not done a box set yet, but they have it, so you can stream it all there. They'll have all those Zatoichi films. They have a lot of Chaplin that they have not put out on disc yet, but they will have streaming. They also say they have licensing deals with Sony, Warner Brothers, Paramount, MGM, Lionsgate, Kino. Found that interesting. Oscilloscope, Shout Factory. This probably includes just a lot of current Criterion discs that they licensed, but they have gotten the streaming rights to, which is cool. But there's also some there that like they do not have anything Shout Factory has on disc. And Shout Factory has a lot of good stuff. Kino has a lot of good stuff, but Kino's stuff doesn't stream, so that's all very exciting too if they've made partnerships with them. And then you asked for recommendations. I went over, they announced what they're going to be highlighting in week one. This is stuff that will be on the service in perpetuity. They're just going to like put it on the front page. They're going to have Alfonso Cuarón's Y Tu Mama También. If you've never seen it, it's so good. I do not think it's a coincidence. Alfonso Cuarón's best two movies are the two he's made in Spanish. And I just say that, not that a Spanish filmmaker can't make a good English language movie. It's just that they're like his most, I think, like personal and down to earth, you know? So if you saw Roma, which is his masterpiece he made last year, you should definitely see Y Tu Mama También. Phenomenal movie. They're going to have Jacques Demy's Umbrellas of Cherbourg, one of the best uses of color ever, and probably the best French musical ever made. They're also going to have David Lynch's The Elephant Man, which is exciting. The Elephant Man has been out of print forever. I have a DVD. It was on Blu-ray briefly from a different company and then went out of print and goes for like hundreds of dollars on eBay. So part of that makes me really hope Criterion is like prepping an Elephant Man Blu-ray, because that would be really cool. Elephant Man is a beautiful movie, and they've gotten a lot more of Lynch's stuff lately. But at the very least, they will be streaming The Elephant Man, and if you've never seen it, one of Lynch's masterpieces.
And you said that Zatoichi is going to be in the initial lineup.
Janus
well.
Owns it, so they would have to, I would assume it would be. It would be weird if it was not. Because they had Zatoichi going back to Hulu.
Yes, yeah, because that's how I originally watched them, was on Hulu.
Yeah, they had Zatoichi for a while before they did the box set.
So that's my recommendation if you have not watched Zatoichi yet. You know, eventually we'll do our Zatoichi podcast. You can get a head start on the Criterion channel.
Yes. And finally, Anthony, repeating a question he asked us last week, but then we did not have a podcast. So Anthony, thank you for asking it again, because I think it's a good question. He said, is it okay that I sometimes don't finish certain games because I just get stuck, or there's a part I don't feel like finishing and decide to go read or watch the rest of it online? I think that's very natural for video games, because video games are long and there's only so many hours in the day.
I was going to say that no, it's not okay. You should man the fuck up, Anthony, and just play video games to the completion. You should, when you start a video game, you should play that video game until it is done. Without a break, no bathroom, no food, no sleep. You just start the, like I did with fucking Devil May Cry 2. One sitting, hard fucking core. No, obviously, it's fine. Like, you know, I've played a number of games with, like, guides to help me. Like, that's how I played through Shenmue 1, partially because I played it in Japanese, so it's confusing. But also, that game is very confusing. So it's, like, good. There are some games I think are good to play with guides. Like, actually, some of the Dark Souls games in Bloodborne. Not, like, how to beat bosses. I didn't want that kind of information. But there's a lot of, like, esoteric, obscure shit around, like, side characters and stuff and access to items that is very easy to miss because they want you to kind of play through those games multiple times for like the really hardcore audience. I don't have the, my life is not long enough to be able to play through Dark Souls five times like over. So like for those kinds of games, I have looked up, how do I get access to this item? Like when I meet a cool side character, I want to make sure, well, how do I keep like following this kind of quest? That kind of stuff I look up all the time when I play games.
Well, and Anthony's asking about specifically, like, what if you just give up on a game and, like, decide, I'll watch the ending online and not play the rest of it?
Yes, no, that's, like, you know, I think it is a personal fault of mine that I tend to finish everything I start, whether it is a TV show or a video game or a book or whatever, even past the point that I don't like it anymore. Yeah.
No, I get that.
I still have that urge. Like, I think it is probably smarter to back out and go to something else that attracts you.
Yeah. I, you know, Anthony, I did a little back and forth with him last week on this because I knew we weren't going to have a podcast. And he was talking specifically about like long RPGs. And I totally get that for a long RPG, especially if you're not feeling it at a certain point, you know? Because also to me, there are some games where it's just like, I got what I needed out of the game without finishing it. You know what I mean? Like I got to a point where it's like, I got this game. I don't need to play more of it to feel like I got it. Like, I have never beat Final Fantasy IV.
Me neither, yeah.
And I love Final Fantasy IV. I will recommend I talk about Final Fantasy IV. I think it's a great game. I've never seen the part where they go to the moon. I also don't feel, like, super pulled into, like, I need to go beat Final Fantasy IV. Because what I've played of it, I love. Final Fantasy VII is that way to me, where I have played all the stuff in the city in Final Fantasy VII that you start in. I've done that, like, three times. And when it gets to the open world, I always get bored with it. I love Final Fantasy VII. The part of it I love is not the entirety of it. Now, it's coming out on Switch again next week, and I actually have it preloaded, so maybe this will be the time I finally beat Final Fantasy VII. But yeah, like, you know, Pokemon games, I've beaten maybe half of the Pokemon games, and the other half of the Pokemon games I haven't, but sometimes I've put a lot of time into, like Sun and Moon. And I don't feel like, you know, I have to stop everything in my life to go finish those games up. You know, I feel like there's a tier of long RPGs that I will always see through to the end, like Persona or Dragon Quest or something like that. And then there's a tier like Pokemon or Final Fantasy where for me, like, if it carries me through all the way to the end, great. If not, you know, like Dragon Age Inquisition, I played 60 fucking hours of. I didn't get to the end. I don't know if that game even has an ending, but I'm happy with it. You know, I did here's what I knew I was done with Dragon Age Inquisition, Sean, is my brother had already played it. And I was doing all the things where you can go to the Inquisitioner's chair and you can, like, pass judgment on people who come through and you can be, like, execute them, throw them in a cell for life. And I did all of those. And then there was no one else coming up to my throne. And I asked Thomas and he said, you did all of them that are in the game. And I don't think I've played Dragon Age Inquisition since because that's what I was there for.
Dragon Age Inquisition is a good example because I kind of had a similar thing with that game where I really liked it. I enjoyed Dragon Age Inquisition. I think it's a game that has a lot of flaws. I played the shit out of that game, and I got, like, I literally got to the point where it starts the, like, and now we're in, like, the final phase. And it's, like, I was with, like, Morgan, and all that stuff was happening, I remember. And it was, I don't think it was quite the, like, you know, the character telling, like, basically it was, like, make sure you save your game, because this is the end. If you want to, it was not, like, literally that, but it was, like, on the way to that. It was like the, oh, if you start doing this next thing, then we're like kind of in the last area of the game and the rest of like all the other areas you haven't been to yet are kind of irrelevant at that point. And there's something about that where I was like, I was very much like, yeah, I'm going to finish this game. And I hit that point and I like saved it and put it down. I was like, I'm going to finish this game probably tomorrow or the next day, put some more time into it. And the next day came and I just didn't play it that day. And then I just never played it again. It was just, I just stopped and I never went back to it. always kind of in there. It was that like 2 or 3 weeks of like in the back of my head, I'm like, I should probably finish Dragon Age Inquisition. Like, I'm right at the end. And eventually it just got far enough away that I realized, well, the least interesting thing about Dragon Age Inquisition to me by far is the main storyline. I kind of don't give a shit about, like, the villain and all. Like, the stuff I liked in Dragon Age Inquisition was the little, like, the stories told in each of the little areas you visited. And I had seen all of those. And the last stuff of the game was the conclusion to the main story I didn't give a shit about. So I stopped there. And I'm glad that, because I think I have fonder memories of that game now than I would have if I had pushed myself through and seen what I imagine is a probably very lackluster conclusion to that game. That, from what I understand, is only gets a lot better if you play the DLC they put out like a year later. But yeah, I don't need all that. I'm fine.
Yeah. You know, sometimes life gets in the way, like for me with Digimon Story, Cyber Sleuth, Hacker's Memory. I wanted to finish that game. I want to go back and finish it. When I do now, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing in it because my Digimon are scattered to the winds with evolution. So I would probably have to play the whole thing again. And I probably will someday because I loved it. But yeah, sometimes that happens too. And that's a little more regrettable. But yeah, video games are weird. They're not like movies. You can't. Like, I don't know, if like someone was saying, yeah, I just watch 2/3 of every movie, and then I turn it off, that'd be a little weird. I'd say, you probably want to get checked out for that. That's an attention disorder. But with games, it's like, yeah, games are weird. They are time-consuming. They are long. Like, you have to have sustained attention in one piece of art for a long time, and it's not like a TV show where it's a passive thing. It's very active, you know? I have a similar problem with books, actually, personally. You know, where sometimes I get, like, I read, like, 1/3 of Stephen King's It, and I really enjoyed it. But it's, like, 2,000 pages, and I never got through it, so.
Yeah, I think another, before we finish this up, another example I thought of, because we were talking about it earlier, is actually Vampire the Masquerade's Bloodline, that original one. Like, I think I probably ultimately didn't play it, it's been, like, 15 fucking years or something since I played that game. I think it was because I hit a save bug, but also, I have no real draw, and I never had a draw to go back and finish that game or play more of it. I think partially because, kind of like with Dragon Age Inquisition and a lot of the other RPGs that I started, like Fallout New Vegas, and never actually finished, or even Skyrim. Like, I never fucking finished the main story of Skyrim. I put, like, 150-something hours in that game across two characters. But the experience of playing a game like that, I get everything I need out of just encountering all the side stories. And there's something about the phenomenon of that feels like, not like watching a TV show streaming, but like back in the day when you watched TV shows when they just air. It was, but not like a new TV show. Is like, here's like just some random episode of Law & Order from like season 4 of Law & Order.
That's me
in the next one.
That's me in Star Trek Next Generation. Like, I love Star Trek The Next Generation when there was a time when you would just turn it on TV. When I try to sit down and, like, watch a season of that show, I don't get through it.
Yeah, exactly. There's something about the experience of, like, there's just all these, like, random side quests that are very satisfying on their own, that tell their own complete stories that are basically completely unrelated. Like, my main favorite part from what I remember Vampire the Masquerade's Bloodline is this whole big haunted house section that's really creepy, and I'm sure it probably is not actually that creepy if you go back and play it now, because it's an old game, but at the time I was like, oh, this is a cool little, like, horror game, in a game that's, even if it's a vampire game, isn't really a horror game. But once I finished that, like, nothing about that haunted house section had anything to do with any other part of that game. And so there's something about the phenomena of that and the way that very episodic storytelling thing can work in games like those kinds of RPGs, or oftentimes JRPGs have a similar kind of feel to them. At a certain point, I've seen enough of those stories that I'm kind of satisfied. And if I move away from it for a long enough time, the pull doesn't exist there because I'm not pulled in by an ongoing storyline. I just have enjoyed the episodes that I watched, and I don't necessarily need to watch literally every single episode of Law & Order or every single episode of Star Wars The Next Generation. I can watch, like, the whatever is in front of me, and I'm kind of good. And that's kind of how some of those very long games feel like to me.
All right, so let's go ahead, Sean. I've been waiting all day and through 2 hours of this dumb podcast. No, I'm kidding. Through this podcast to talk about Jordan Peele's Us. So, if you have not seen Us, I recommend it wholeheartedly.
Absolutely.
Go see it.
100%.
Go see it. Spoilers from here. You don't want it spoiled. Mostly just because it's really good. That's why you don't want it spoiled. Deep breath. Sean, this movie is amazing. I loved Get Out also. You saw Get Out, right?
Yes.
Okay. We both liked that movie. Get Out was in my top 10. I think it's a great film. It's an important film. It's a super interesting film in so many ways. I think I like Us more.
I agree, yeah.
And it is, I think, you know, Jordan Peele, like, even if before Get Out, we all knew Jordan Peele was a great writer. You watch 5 seconds of Key and Peele and you know this dude is very smart and funny and incisive in a lot of different ways. Get Out is a tremendous screenplay. It's an extremely well-directed movie. I wouldn't take anything away from that film's direction. I do think there is a leap in filmmaking skill between that film and this one that is, like, Us is one of the best-made American films I've seen in years. It is ridiculously well-crafted.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Just, like, it's one of those movies where I could break it down shot by, and I would have fun doing this, like with a room of students, just shot by shot. Why was this shot chosen? Why are we tracking here? Why are we doing a pull focus here? Why do we have Elizabeth Moss on the floor crawling to the Beach Boys? And why is the camera at that position? And why is this scene so fucking crazy good? Like, that sort of thing. The editing is out of this world. There's that sustained section in the middle of the movie where the four family members are separated and they're each being chased by their doppelganger. The cross-cutting in that section and how they are keeping the geography of the house and the area around it and the four different lines of action going on at the same time. It is just like the filmmaker, film scholar in me was just mind-boggled and humbled by the skill going on. And I don't even think that's the most skillful part of the movie. Like, it's insanely good.
Absolutely. And, I think one thing that's interesting about it, like, putting it next to Get Out, is this feels it feels similar to Get Out in a lot of ways. Like, you can definitely tell it comes from the same sort of creative person with the same creative interests. But there's something so much more, I think, subtly confident about this movie to me, and the ways that, like, you know, Get Out is a really fascinating movie, but it wears its fascinations, like, on its skin, like, which is not to say that it's a skin deep movie or something, but it is, like, very upfront with, like, its subject matter and its symbology and everything like that. It's like, it's very in your face about it, which is fine. Like, and it's very good and it's an interesting movie, but there's something about Us that it feels like the symbolism is not as easy in this. It's not as plain. It feels, you know, more Lynchian in not the way that most people use the word Lynchian of like dreamlike or something, but more Lynchian in the sense of like, I don't feel like there are very easy answers or connections for most of the things in the movie. I think most of the things in the movie are complicated in a way that Get Out kind of didn't go for.
Get Out is one of the supreme crowd pleasers of the decade.
Yes.
And that is not to say it is facile or simple. It is not. It has a lot of interesting things on its mind, and I think sparked a lot of interesting conversations. But I was in the theater for Get Out. I actually saw Get Out like 2 months late, and it was still sold out, and that theater still went crazy for it. I mean, Get Out has beats that like Jordan Peele can play an audience like a fucking fiddle when you watch Get Out, and where every laugh is timed, and where every cheer is timed, and where every scream is timed. It's amazing in that sense. And Get Out also ends on a very clear up with his TSA friend coming in and saving the day, and it's a great joke, and you get to feel a little good going out of that movie. Us is not a crowd pleaser. Like resolutely it is not that. It is ambiguous, it is unresolved, it leaves you out of the theater chewing on a lot of big ideas and complicated imagery from which there is no easy conclusion to be made. And I heard people in the theater getting frustrated with it. Like, I think there were people there thinking they were getting Get Out too. And this is not that at all. Like, as you say, there are easy ways that they're related, but like it is a very different film. Like, I would just say, like, the way he employs humor in this film is very different. Like, Get Out kind of stops for laughs. Like, it cuts to places where you're going to have comedy. One of the most skillful moments, and I'm going to come back to that word a lot. It is so skillful and confident in Us, is where the doppelganger family comes into the house, and they've rallied. There's that amazing tracking shot that goes all through the house as they're coming in. That's so good. But anyway, they've got them all wrangled up on the couch, and you've got the main family on the couch and the doppelganger family standing by the fireplace, right? And Lupita Nyong'o as Red, the doppelganger, gives that speech in that horrible whispery voice about everything. And it is such an intense scene. And it is sustained horror and tension. And you don't really know what she's talking about. And it is freaky. And then he drops this joke in there. And it's a joke. It was very dark humor where the Winston Duke character, the husband, is like, look, I'll give you money. I'll give you whatever you want. You want that boat? I don't even really want that fucking boat. And that is such a great moment because what he's doing there with the humor is very clearly taking a little pressure off. Like, just opening the valve a tad because you are so wound up by the end of Lupita's speech. I think that's a slightly different employment of humor than Get Out has. And it's not the crowd-pleasing way of that. Like, I laughed at a lot of moments in this movie, but I realized a lot of my theater was, like, not sure how to react to things.
Yeah, because I think the humor is such an interesting part of this movie because I think especially after the big sort of set-piece scene of the doppelgangers coming to the house in the full encounter between the two families, and then you have the scene where the white family encounters the doppelgangers, just gets fucking massacred immediately, and then our main cast comes to and encounters their house and kills the white doppelgangers. Like, after that point, the humor in the movie becomes very peculiar in a way I found really fascinating. Of, like, because, like you said, it's not, the movie's not, I don't think, asking you to laugh at it necessarily. Like, some of it did work on, like, the humor worked on me in a laugh kind of way, but it's not just being like a, like, Get Out, here's like a solid, like, setup punchline kind of gag that you're supposed to laugh at. Like, it's a comedy movie. This is like, there is something off about these characters being funny here and being kind of okay to a certain extent with what is going on in a way that a horror movie doesn't normally do this. Like, most horror movies, when they would reach this part, are not going for there being like this peculiar character-based humor between your main cast, because usually at this point the main cast isn't even together anymore. Which is something I like about this movie, is that the main cast comes together and stays together for a long section in the middle. And there's something about that I feel is like the tone of the movie is so unique and peculiar and of itself that it is not like Get Out. It is not like this like good time horror comedy kind of thing. This is something very specific that just feels like it's going for something different than what most horror movies go for. It just has this, like, the whole movie has this very like 70s vibe to it. I fucking adore in terms of its construction. And I think that's part of it. It feels like it comes from something like that, where it's going for its own unique tone and is not trying to sort of match tones with other contemporary films.
The 70s is actually a really good comparison, because what's famous about the big movies of the 70s is you leave those movies wanting to put a fucking gun in your mouth. Like, they are so dark, mm-hmm. and they are so, you know, like, the punch of every major movie of the 70s is that you lose entirely, and you get your fucking nose rubbed in it, right? Like, you know, I think probably the most famous and acclaimed of these is Network, the Paddy Chayefsky movie, but, like, you could go any number of examples for the 1970s. The Conversation by Francis Ford Coppola is one that's really good about just he gets his fucking nose rubbed in it. And this is kind of like that. I don't know if it's quite... No, it is as brutal in its own way. It's just not as clear what has happened. But, like, this is a movie that... It is not Get Out. You do not leave the theater on an up. You leave the theater on a... Oh, fuck. Oh, mother. That... Oh, God. Like, that's kind of the feeling of it. And I like that. in a masochistic way.
Because definitely when you think about it, at the end of this movie... it seems like most of the population of America has been murdered violently by their doppelgangers via scissor stabbings. And then they have now, you know, mimicked the Hands Across America thing, that they're all dressed in red. It has like the ending of a fucking zombie movie, basically, where it's like the humanity has lost, the doppelgangers have won, to the extent that the main character we have been following is actually the doppelganger one the entire time. Like, it's entirely... they have taken over and they have become us, if you want to do the title drop.
No, it's I'm glad they do not do that at the end of the movie, Sean, and have like the daughter go back and like explain the scenario, her prediction to like Winston Duke, and he's like, honey, I'm sorry, I think they have become us. Cut to black. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they don't. Jordan Peele's smarter than that. But it is this, there is an unresolvable tension to the issues the movie brings up, you know? And it is, like, I will say, when I was watching the movie, I was reading it on a very psychological level. It is very Freudian. There is a lot of, like, you know, like a famous reading of Psycho is that the house in Psycho, Norman Bates' house, has three levels, and the three levels are super ego, ego, id. And the id is the basement because that's where he's keeping the dead mother. Sorry, I spoiled Psycho. I think that's okay, right?
I think that's fine. Yeah, I think if people do not know that Psycho is about a dude that kills people because of his dead mom, I'm sorry.
Yeah, it's, I don't know what
that
to
movie
do.
Came out a long time ago.
Yes. Anyway, like, I think this movie has something similar but not quite as literal going on, but, like, there is, like, a, you know, there is a traveling into the id and things coming out of the id in the base, in this, like, underground world we've constructed and pushed down all this stuff, and it comes up very violently and destructively, and that's kind of how I was seeing a lot of the movie. And then I immediately, like, I was sitting in my car for a while before I, like, left the parking lot because I just had to read about this movie, and I'm flipping through some articles, and there's a lot of very interesting political readings about this movie. One thing I found really curious, though, is that in, like, the three or four articles I looked at, they were not the same three or four political readings. Like, I think there's a generalized political reading you can do here about, like, hidden American sins, possibly tied to race, but not entirely, I think, in this film's case, about, you know, what is pushed beneath the surface and ignored and left out. You know, there's a reason he chose the Million Hands March or whatever that was called. You know, there's some really interesting connections in that. But I also just think, like, it works on a psychological level so pure, you don't need to bring an ounce of allegory into it. Although I do think all of that is there. I think in some ways, thematically, it's kind of a Rorschach test of a movie in terms of what you're probably going to take out of it. But yeah, it's really interesting on that regard. And you know, I always have said Get Out is going to be just, and it already is, one of film school's favorite movies, because Get Out is kind of film school the movie in terms of, like, what it's referencing and how it uses intertextuality. I think Us is going to be pretty big on that level, too, because it is psychoanalytic in a lot of interesting ways.
Absolutely. And I think some of the stuff you were just talking about is kind of like a better, it's giving me a better way to express what I was trying to say earlier with, like, Get Out. I think it's, you can read deeper and deeper nuances into what that movie is saying, but I think what that movie is saying is very clear. It's not trying to hide the symbolism and, like, the messaging of the way that, like, America culture, like, or just appropriates black bodies and black physicality and black culture. Like, that's just what that movie is saying. Whereas with Us, it is more of that tapestry that, like, you are reflecting so much of what you are bringing to the movie off of the material that the movie has and reading what you are bringing to it from the movie. And that's, like, the Lynchian quality to it, is it's so much reflecting what you have brought to it specifically, and it's not projecting as much onto the viewer, I think, which is more my personal preference for art. And so, yeah, so this movie definitely, I've went to the same places as Freud. I mean, partially because Freud wrote, like, the most famous essay about doppelgangers. So, like, it's inevitable to bring a Freudian reading to it. And you know, anytime you do doppelgangers, you do uncanny and all that stuff. So that is there. And the ego stuff, I think, is 100% there. Anytime you have people fucking going down, like, into the basement and, like, the tunnels of America. Yeah, there's a definitely very Freudian quality to that. But then I also definitely saw so much of the political stuff. I think I really want to now reread W.E.B. Du Bois's essay about the veil and double consciousness, for, like, the race side of the movie, of the concept that growing up and being African American or being black in America is being of two people, and having to be, like, in looking through this veil and seeing white America and having to live behind it and live in black America and have this double consciousness of being able to live and pass in both spheres. I think there's a quality to that of where the main characters are black, but they live in a very white kind of situation, like generically white American situation, and they have this, like, rich white family that they're friends with, and the black family that comes to them that are the doppelgangers have this very Childish Gambino, This Is America quality to them of expressing this, like, exaggerated, paradised version of blackness in America. Like, there's something with that going on, and then there's definitely something going on with, hey, here's the hands across America, like, of the 80s, of this idealized, like, we're banding together and taking care of this shit. But then, you know, the 80s is also the site of the AIDS epidemic and the failure of America to actually be able to take care of that shit, and many rising racial tensions that would come to a head in the 90s, and Reaganism, and the economic situation with that. And so it's like there's a certain idealism, especially with like our nostalgia for the 80s that we project onto that decade, that is not deserved, that no time period deserves, but definitely not the 80s in America, and those sins being buried and hidden, coming back to light. I think that's a big part of what I saw in the movie as well.
Totally. The W.B. Du Bois piece you mentioned, I've already seen one article I read that uses that extensively. Because I do think the double consciousness thing is like, you can't ignore it here. Like, that's definitely an idea in the movie.
Yeah.
But a really, like, rich and interesting one because of all the ways it is put in tension with these other ideas, including the like Hands Across America thing, which was specifically for poverty, and you know, in the Reagan 80s, that's a rich irony. You know, it also was not a protest that went particularly well. I was reading about, so like, yeah, I think it's, you know, honestly, like you brought up Lynch, and actually one of the only movies I could think that I would find comparable to Us in any way, and it's such a different movie, is Blue Velvet. Like, there's something about Blue Velvet, too, where I don't think Lynch is generally apolitical and doesn't get into that kind of stuff, but I do think there's a quality where both of these movies almost feel like parables in a way, where they are very stylish, they are eminently watchable, they are incredibly well made, but there is this kind of parable quality to it, where at the end, there's a lot of different ideas you can get out of the movie, but I think it's very resistant to any one reading that carries through start to finish. Mm-hmm. And I think you see that here. Like, yeah, and Blue Velvet also being very Freudian, where I think Blue Velvet is mainly about, you know, a certain kind of dangerous masculinity that hides in the id of the, you know, upstanding white American man. I think Us probably is that kind of story for this, maybe, the double consciousness kind of issue and that sort of part of the id ego, but that also extends the way they do it all throughout society in Us to something America has repressed. So, you know, there is that line where, like, one of the most pointed lines in the movie is, I think it's doppelganger Lupita says, you know, we are Americans, and that's obviously a very damning line. But part of what I loved about Us because of that is as I'm watching it, I didn't know where it was going, plot-wise, you know. I knew we were going to see those bunnies again, but other than that, I was like, really, where are they going with this?
And yeah, that's maybe the most 70s part of the whole movie,
good.
Is the slow pan out from the fucking, of the bunnies in this classroom. You're like, did I go into the wrong movie theater? Like, is this the right, is this, okay, yeah, it's okay, this is Us. It's like, there was a moment, especially because they started playing the movie like 3 minutes early for some reason. My movie theater, I was very confused. And so there are people coming in there like, why is the movie already starting? It's like, did we go to the wrong movie theater? And then the movie started with the prologue thing. It's like, well, this seems like this is probably Us. And then the bunny thing happened. It's like, is there another horror movie that's in the movie theaters right now with like a predominantly black cast? Because this is weird.
Yeah. But that, oh, Sean, I just about standed up and applauded when I realized what he was doing with the opening credits. And he was going to go the entire opening credits on one pullback from the eye of a bunny to an entire classroom full of bunnies. That is such a bravura piece of confidence, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I fucking love it. But while I'm watching the movie, I really was having to wait continually to try to come to any one reading, and I was getting a lot of ideas out of it, and I'm sitting there appreciating the filmmaking, but even by the end, it is so resistive to one single interpretation that I feel like I have barely started digesting this movie. You know, like, we're going to talk about it here, and I desperately want to go see it again, in part because the twist at the end, I almost don't even want to call it a twist. I know it is one, but it is not a twist in like the M. Night Shyamalan sense of the whole movie is about the twist. I think the twist in Us rewrites a lot of the movie thematically, but I don't think the movie is about the twist. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree. And I think it is, it's one of those, again, in another very Lynchian kind of thing, a lot of the movie is about like setting up expectations for reading and then providing something that heavily complicates it. That final twist being the last example of that. For me, the biggest one was realizing that, oh, it's not just this family that has doppelgangers. And then when you see the white family and they have their doppelgangers as well. Because that was the one where it's like, up to that point, I was like so good of like, yeah, the veil, double consciousness, this is America. Like, I was, like, on my shit, my critical shit with all of this and, like, W.B. Du Bois. And I was like, it's been a few years since I read any Du Bois, but I'm on this. I'm with you. I'm with you, Jordan Peele. I'm on playing your game. And then it was like, oh, fuck. Okay. Yeah. Okay. This is more... It's the argument the movie is making is much bigger in scope than I would have initially imagined. And the movie, I think, continues to do that up to that final twist.
But, you know, like Get Out, an easy way to give the log line of Get Out is it's the Stepford Wives, but with white people as the villains. Like, it's not the husbands replacing the wives. It's white people replacing the minds and bodies of black people, right? Mm-hmm. Us, I guess the log line would be, it is the genre of the home invasion thriller, but the home is the United States of America. You know, and where we are being invaded from is the oh my god, the tunnels. The way the movie opens with the fucking thing about there is a series of tunnels throughout the United States, and we don't know where they come from. I was like, what is this open? It's such a weird, like, left hook.
And imagine that, but the movie starts playing like 5 minutes before it's supposed to start playing.
That's amazing.
So now you see why, because I had forgotten that was what it was, that's what really set me off, is like, the movie just started playing. I'm like, why is the movie like? And like, I think it's the Universal logo came up, and I didn't remember which studio. It was like, is Universal? It's like, why is it? And I checked my phone. It's like, it's playing early. And then this thing about fucking tunnels comes up. It's like, what fucking movie am I watching? And then it's like, okay, no, this seems like this is Us. And then it's a bunch of buddies in a classroom. I'm like, is this Us? And then the words Us came on screen. I'm like, okay, I'm in the right fucking movie theater.
It's such a... I mean, when you talk about confidence, it takes some real confidence for that to be the first thing you show an audience in a movie, is that little text scroll about the fucking tunnels under DIA. Like, because we're both from Denver, like, that's one of the epicenters of all the, like, conspiracy theories about tunnels, is the tunnels under DIA, the airport. And it's like, okay, the trailers gave me no indication of the tunnels thing. But yeah, like, well, you know, going back to what I was saying, is like, it is, so like, just the scope of this movie is so wide, in that, again, it is not one particular horror movie it's grappling with. It is an entire genre, and it is using it to pick apart an entire sort of national sense of identity. That is fascinating to me. You know, I hope none of this sounds like we're putting down Get Out. And it's not even really necessary to compare them. They're both great movies, and I think they both do what they set out to do amazingly well, right? But as it is Jordan Peele's other film, I think it's fair to compare them. And I just would say, like, Get Out is one of those movies where I feel like I got it watching it in the theater and loved it. I remember when I went to do my top 10 list, I put the DVD on, my screener, and I fell into, I'm like, it's so good. But about an hour in, I'm like, I had so many other things to do. I'm preparing a top 10 list. I'm watching, you know, 30 different movies. I'm like, okay, I've seen this. Maybe I'll go back to it again one day, but I took it out. And I think Us, I like want to watch this movie 5 times. It's a very different kind of feeling. And that to me is also just an example of just evolution in skill and ambition, you know?
Yeah, and the other, like, thinking about, like, sort of genre for this movie is way more an Invasion of the Body Snatchers movie than I thought it was going to be going in from the trailers. Just because, again, I thought the scope of the movie was going to be doppelganger for this, like, one family. I love fucking doppelganger stories. There's very few of them. It's very rarely done. So I am fucking in for it. And then you get that reveal of that it's everybody. And it's 100%, it just becomes like a... This is like the sixth version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Obviously, it's very much its own take, but it feels like it is an Invasion of the Body Snatchers movie, of which there's like 5 or 6. Like, there, people have remade that movie a bunch.
Yes.
But this, like thinking about the 70s thing, this feels like the 70s, like it's inspired by the 70s version of Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It's all like, even down to a lot of the noises that they make sounds kind of like the thing they do in that movie, where when a body snatcher sees a normal human, they point at them and open their mouth and go and like yell at them, and if they make that kind of noise, it's got that quality to it, which I appreciate because I love that fucking movie too.
Oh, I mean, Jordan Peele, one of the things that really distinguishes this as a movie from the guy who made Get Out is he knows his film history. He's seen all of it. He's digested all of it very clearly. And so when he is referencing things or building on things. It is from a very rich and deep foundation that he is playing with all these elements. And that's one of the reasons why I said, you know, Get Out is a film school movie, because if you know the same stuff, you're going to go wild for it. I think Us has those qualities, but the remix is much more complex going on here. Not that you have to know any of that stuff to get this movie. You absolutely don't. But, like, there is... This is a guy who has, like, done his homework when he's talking about this stuff. And that sets this apart from, I think, you know, other people who have played in a similar sandbox, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay, I want to talk about the first scene of this movie. The prologue, where she... It's the young... I forget her name. I think it's Adelaide is Lupita Nyong'o's character. I only noticed it in the credits because I don't think they say her name in the actual text of the movie.
Yeah, it's going to be a difficulty of this movie is that they very rarely ever say character names.
Yes. Yeah, but Lupita Nyong'o's character Adelaide as a little girl with her mother and father. Well, the very first scene is her watching the scene of the million hands across America, which I also had no idea where the movie was going with that. But then it is that long prologue where she is at the amusement park on the... What beach were they at? It's...
Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz. They're at Santa Cruz. And Sean, I could have watched an entire two-hour movie of a little girl walking around a freaky amusement park, because amusement parks are freaky to begin with, and Jordan Peele does a phenomenal job in that sequence centering you in the POV of a little girl for whom this is a much bigger world than it would be for an adult. And just, oh, that sequence is so good you want to bathe in it. Just the amount of time spent watching her just move around this space, and everything is sort of creepy and askew, even though very little happens in that scene until the doppelganger shows up at the very end. Nothing, like, overtly terrifying happens. It's just the way these mundane facts of this, like, awful piece of Americana, this Santa Cruz boardwalk with this, like, very gaudy amusement park and all these things, ending up in that kind of gaudy hall of mirrors. It is a great short film in and of itself. I absolutely could have watched two more hours just of that. It is such an interesting little piece there. And, you know, it's also very intentional that that is sort of the piece of Americana around which a lot of the movie and the trauma is centered. It is very interesting to me. You know, these places of, like, manufactured wonder and horror. That, I knew we were in for something special just from that sequence. And then the fucking bunnies just stand up and applaud. That was enough for me. I knew I loved this movie.
Absolutely. And any time you have a scene in a movie that takes place in a hall of mirrors, I am all for it. Lady from Shanghai, Enter the Dragon, John Wick 2.
John Wick 2. Yeah.
It's just anytime, it's just fucking awesome. Like, you just have a character go into a room that has a bunch of fucking mirrors in it. Great.
The collected
I'm
works
sure
of
those scenes must be fucking hard to shoot, because you're in a room with a bunch of mirrors in it, but it always looks fucking rad.
Yeah, I was going to say the collected works of Wong Kar-wai, if you want, like, the art house version of that. Yeah, no, it's so good. The little girl who plays young Adelaide is really good. Like, that is a full three-course dinner of a performance in a 10-minute, you know, scene. And it mm-hmm. flashes back to it a lot. She's really good. All the kid performances are fantastic in this, but I really was taking note of that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because also, it's no small task to be the person tasked to play young Lupita Nyong'o, who is giving the performance she's giving in this movie. Let's talk about that. You flash for the future. Lupita Nyong'o is insanely good in this movie. And I have always said, like, she... This was not her film debut, but the movie that she kind of had her breakout in was 12 Years a Slave. She wins the Oscar for that. Have you seen 12 Years a Slave?
No, I have not.
You should, because it's a great movie, and she is phenomenal in that as a character named Patsy, and like I said, won the Oscar for it. And she's only kind of gone up from there for me, because she is such a chameleonic actress. No two performances she's given feel similar to me. Like, in this movie, when she is sitting across from herself, part of the uncanny is that those do not feel like the same person. That is like if you told me, like, someone else played the doppelganger and I didn't know who Lupita Nyong'o was, I might believe you, because it is such a fully realized performance in both of those spaces. Just a killer performance from her.
Absolutely, yeah, because then she's tasked to play both of those characters, and the physicality for both of the characters is completely different, and I love what she brings to the physicality of the doppelganger. Adelaide, because, like, her that whole background, once you like find out the background of, oh, that she was a dancer, and they kind of start incorporating that again at the end of the movie, it makes her like very light steps and her very like kind of strange way of moving through the environment like takes on such a different turn. And yeah, it's a really impressive performance.
So good.
And on both sides of it.
Yeah. And everyone else is good too. You know, I like Winston Duke here a lot. He's been, you know, tearing it up recently. I think he's M'Baku in Black Panther, right?
Yes. So we have a whole Black Panther reunion, yes, with Lupita Nyong'o and Winston Duke, and that was fun.
And this is what I mean by Lupita being chameleonic, is compare this to Black Panther. It is hard to believe right, that's yeah. the same actor, right? Mm-hmm. And same for Winston Duke, who I love. Like, M'Baku is like, you know, this big beefy guy who like leads this clan kind of out in the wilderness, or at least up in the mountains, you know, away from the rest of the society. And here he's playing kind of like the pudgy father figure who's kind of let himself go. And it's, again, it's just, there's a lot of range there. He's very good at selling the comedic bits of this movie, because most of it's on his shoulders when there's comedy. Mm-hmm. And yet the character does not feel like a comic figure to me. He's a guy yeah. who is funny at times, but that's not his sole role in the movie.
Yeah, he's the goofy dad who's like had a few too many years of dad jokes under his belt.
Yes.
Like, that's like the kind of character he's playing, and I love it.
Yeah, both of the kids are... Man, the boy child... who has to do, I mean, I assume that's him under the, I assume there's probably stunt doubles for some of it, but like there's a lot of physicality in how the doppelganger boy moves, the very animalistically and all that. He's very impressive throughout this movie. And I yeah. think the girl is too. She's probably the member of the family who gets the least development, but the great cast, and Jordan Peele can add very good at directing children to his list of things he is like uncommonly good at.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, and if like the child performances didn't work in this movie wouldn't work, because they're so
yeah.
prominent, both for that prologue and then for the two kids throughout the film.
Can I tell you something that made me laugh throughout this whole movie? Is
what?
So the boy has that Chewbacca mask, or mm-hmm. generic Wolfman. It looked like Chewbacca to me, but like it looked like Chewbacca to me because my brother Thomas had a Chewbacca mask like that. And I don't mean my brother Thomas when he was the age of the character in the movie. I mean Thomas at the age of 23 last year. He had gone to this party, and he got a slightly better mask than, because the boy just has like a paper mask. Thomas got one that like talked and made Chewbacca sounds and was like hard plastic. And he got it for a Halloween party, but he had it in his car for like a year. And every time I'd get in his car, he had this fucking Chewbacca mask, and he's just driving around with it. I'm like, you ever gonna do anything with that Chewbacca mask? I don't know. And it just made me laugh throughout this movie that there's this character with a Chewbacca mask, and I couldn't stop thinking about Thomas being way too old to have that Chewbacca mask in his car.
I like this, like the image of you like going into his room for whatever reason, you just see him at the computer just wearing the Chewbacca mask. He's like, Jonathan, get out of my room! You don't understand!
All I can say is Thomas was really lucky he never got pulled over by the cops in that year, because they would have been like, license, registration... Why do you have a Chewbacca mask in your car? They would have assumed he killed a child, right?
Yeah, he was like robbing banks or whatever instead of like a...
Yeah,
instead of a fucking like whatever mask.
Ski mask or hockey mask.
Mask. Yeah.
He's got a Chewbacca mask. Anyway, nothing to do with the movie itself. The whole theme of masks is very interesting there. Talking about some other members of the cast, Elizabeth Moss is not in this much as the wife of the other family. But there is one shot she has as the doppelganger putting on lipstick. That is an entire performance in a single shot. That, like, that one shot and the performance she gives as this doppelganger trying on makeup and, like, trying on smiles, that is why you get Elizabeth Moss for the movie. Is, like, other than that, you don't necessarily need an actor of that caliber for that role. It's a fairly small part. But that, and I would say also the entire Good Vibrations scene, it is just, oh my god, it's such a good performance in miniature, you know?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So we've got the characters out of the way. Let's talk about, you know, the story and the filmmaking. I already mentioned just how skillful I find, like, the different pieces of story going on, especially in the big home invasion sequence in the middle, the editing, the cinematography. I also want to talk about the use of music in this movie. Because one, you have an amazing, amazing score. I forget the name of the composer, and I'll look that up now, but we can talk about that in a second. But you also have, I think, just some killer uses of incidental music. The entire scene in the White family's house, where you have Good Vibrations playing under the murders, and then Fuck the Police by NWA playing over the next half of that. Because that also is like, the film has been so tense for so long. It is such, again, it's just releasing the pressure valve a little bit. Because I would not say those scenes are actively funny, like you're laughing out loud at the entire thing. But they are playful in a way that is exactly what you need at that moment in time. Again, Jordan Peele is really good at reading an audience.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's where, like, the humor gets that, like, peculiar turn. Where it's like, it becomes kind of dark in a way that, like, I was not expecting this movie to try to do. But it's like, because it is releasing the pressure valve a little bit, but it's also, in so doing, it's adjusting and changing the tone of the movie. It's not just letting it off with a little bit of levity. It's like using that levity to progress to another tone.
Mm-hmm. And just like, again, the way this movie uses music is so synesthetic to me, where just the songs and the edit to the songs and the cinematography that's going with the songs, whether this is score or Good Vibrations or whatever, it is such a complete package. I'm on cloud nine. Like, that's one of my favorite things in movies, is when you get good synesthesia going. This is one of those. The composer's name is Michael Abels. He also did Get Out. Get Out has a good score, too. This is one of the best film scores I've heard in years. I very rarely these days walk out of a movie noticing a score. It's happened to me three times this year so far. How to Train Your Dragon, Apollo 11, and Get Out, and Us. And I'm very happy, because there's not enough good film music in the world.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, the sequence where Adelaide is fighting her doppelganger at the end, which is this long, extended brawl they have. The score for that section, the way it is shot, the brutality of it, and the way it is doing all these jump cuts to the dancing, and the rhythmic nature of all of it, it boggles my mind how it was made. Like, because it is so precise, yeah. I know they didn't find it in the edit. Like, they had to shoot for it. But, like, shooting for all of that, Michael Abels being able to score it that precisely and feel like the music was there first, even though it probably wasn't, it's a crazy achievement. And I think you look at that, you look at the Good Vibration sequence, it's such a total package, you know?
Yeah, no, and since you broached it, let's talk about that, the fight scene at the end of the movie, because that is one of the best one-on-one fight scenes that American movies have produced in years.
Yeah.
Like, in fucking years. And it's unbelievable to me that it comes from a fucking horror movie. But just the sense of, like, we have been building up to this confrontation for the entire film. We have been developing this confrontation between these two characters for the entire film. And then they meet together, like, in this cool new location in this classroom with the fucking rabbits in the background. And then the music starts playing, and they're pacing around the room, staring at each other like it's a fucking Western. And they're going to, like, you know, they're going to have to draw at the same time. It's like, how do movies not get this part right? Because they never fucking get that, like... I don't think any Marvel movie has ever developed the confrontation between the hero and villain as well as this movie does. And it's like, you're a fucking comic book movie. Like, the whole fucking thing is building up between a confrontation between your superhero and your supervillain, especially once you are past the origin. That's the thing. Like, that's what you're doing. And the sense of, like, climax and momentum and just sort of, like, achievement by the time you've reached this is like this sort of apotheosis of the movie by the time you get to the end and arriving at the conflict and the, like, direct conflict between these two characters that have been, like, literally dancing around for the whole movie up to this point is so satisfying that it makes me want Jordan Peele for his next movie to just make a fucking martial arts action movie, because he can, based on that scene, he could fucking do it. Like, that's how impressive that fight scene is to me.
Yeah, and it's interesting because it's not, I had not thought of it in that regard, but I think it's a good point, because it's not a fight scene in the sense of a martial arts action scene where, like, you're rooting for cool moves and stuff. It's a very terse, you know, like, tense scene because you don't want people to get hurt and that sort of thing, right? But it is the way it is thrilling and the way it is kind of stomach churning and all that, it is so well developed. Part of it, I think, Sean, like asking it, why don't other movies do this, is it's just the confidence to fucking do it. And like, because that's the fight at the end of this movie, it is well lit. It is clearly framed. You see everything. I don't know how the fuck they did that with two Lupita Nyong'os. Like, very good stunt work and blocking, I guess. But like, you know, it's just, it's there's only one actress. She doesn't have a twin. So like, you know, all of that is crazy. You know, a lot of Us does happen in low light environments, but it's a very well lit movie. Like, things are very clear. Jordan Peele never takes the cop out that is very common in horror movies and in action movies of like going into the dark, shaking the camera, and like obscuring it, because that's a lot easier than actually choreographing. And the end of Us is so well choreographed. It is so like precisely lit, which does not always mean bright, but it means visible and evocative. And every movement of that fight is progressing a character dynamic, whether it's the balletic stuff, whether it is giving you this sense that something is up with the Adelaide we've known the entire movie, because she is getting more sort of animalistic and brutal the way the doppelgangers are, and there seems to be this transference going on there. Like, there is so much story being told that, like, this is the part of the horror movie that is usually perfunctory, and if you don't care that much, like, this is the part where, like, Michael Myers shows up at the end for the last thing, and it's all going to be in the complete darkness, and they're eventually going to get an axe in his head or something, right? And then he's going to disappear.
Yeah.
That's where you, like, if you don't really care, you probably get up and leave so you can get to your car before everyone else. That is not the focus of Us. And I do think it is important to think of it in terms of just that fight choreography, because it is the complete package, and it wants you to see it and to make something out of it.
Yeah, and using all the footage of the ballet performance to like intercut, and then the music in particular is such a huge part of what makes it so powerful. And like, honestly, the touchstone, since American movies are so bad at doing this, this touchstone I have to go to for me recently isn't even a movie. This, it feels like the final boss fight in a Yakuza game. It feels like we have been building up and we have seen this confrontation and these two characters kind of dance around each other, and we've been building up these themes, and it's like that scene where they encounter each other in the fucking room, the classroom, and the music starts playing and the beat starts picking up. It's like one step away from Lupita Nyong'o just ripping her shirt off and having a fucking dragon tattoo on her back, you know, and then going and punch each other in the face, and like this big name that's like Doppelganger Red smashes onto the screen, and then a controller pops out of the screen in front of me or whatever, and I start playing. Like, that's what it felt like. And it's just like, how come so many movies are so bad at delivering this kind of feeling to me when it feels like you should be able to do this? Like, it was just like this moment I had where it's like, it just felt like such a revelation that I so rarely see this in movies, particularly movies I see when I sit in at a theater, when most of the movies I go to at a theater are like action superhero kind of movies that you feel like the number one thing, well, not the number one thing, but like a thing, an important thing they should have to hit is this moment, in a way that Us would be an amazing movie, even if it didn't quite nail this scene, because most horror movies, as you said, don't nail the last scene particularly well. The fact that it does nail this scene, not just better than most horror movies, but most action movies or most other movies about two characters facing off with each other at the end of the film, it just pushes this movie to a whole other level to me.
If I had a genie, Sean, one of my three wishes now would be that Takeshi Kitano makes a new Yakuza movie, and it stars Lupita Nyong'o as an American woman who moves to Japan and joins the Yakuza, and we would have the scene where she rips the shirt off and has a full back tattoo in traditional Japanese style. She could pull it off.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, this, and again, like, she's fighting herself, so she can pull it off from both sides with both characters, both the protagonist and the antagonist.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. Talking about, I mean, we could do a whole additional podcast, Sean, on just spitballing about the symbolism in this movie. But like, as we're going back through it, there are so many layers that I would reread so differently on a second viewing because of the way the movie ends. And one of them is, you know, Adelaide has shackles on her wrists for most of the movie because the doppelganger puts her in handcuffs. And so she's in handcuffs. She has use of her hands, but she's in handcuffs most of the film. And I was kind of unsure of how exactly to read that. You look at it now, like, that the fight of that, like, that last battle is for her to kill the other, get the key, uncuff herself. That's when she's finally free, and the just brutal, dark 70s-style kicker is she was the doppelganger all along, and, you know, the way, like, Red is the name of her doppelganger, kind of invites her death at the end, where she, like, brings the spear in, like, that style, kind of like Lutz in Fellowship of the Ring, you know?
Yes.
yes, exactly. I knew you were going to do the sound. Anyway, is because she's kind of like pushing the whole movie for the actual doppelganger to stand up and like take her freedom. And she does that. But of course, the revelation that that's what has happened is such a bleak mind fuck. Like, Jordan Peele has definitely passed the test for being the guy to do the Twilight Zone, because that is a Twilight Zone ass ending, you know?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it is. It is. It is like, what if we had an R-rated Twilight Zone in many ways?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, man. But just, this movie is, again, so ridiculously well made. You know, there's been a lot of conversation about film editing lately because the Oscar for editing this year went to Bohemian Rhapsody, which is objectively a terribly edited movie. And I've already seen some good video essays on people. It doesn't take a lot of effort, but just to point out, like, why that movie is really poorly edited. This is, like, the exact qualitative inverse. Like, every single cut in Us is so perfectly motivated. Whether you're noticing it or not, and you're probably not noticing it because good editing is editing you generally don't notice, but like, again, that entire home invasion sequence where you are juggling four separate lines of action between these characters, and so you're not just thinking about how to cut for clarity, but to cut for keeping the momentum of action going when you are having sustained, you know, beats of tension and horror and having to keep that in mind across four separate storylines, essentially. Whereas, you know, most horror movies are going to keep you kind of in one place for that at a certain point, but it's all four, and just the cutting there is so smart, and it is so motivated, and it is so precise. And then you do get things that are showier, like the dancing in the final sequence, that's just kind of mind-blowing how you even cut that, because it's giving a sense of momentum that I'm not even sure is there in the images, but the dance cutting on, like, a movement in dance to a movement in the thing makes everything feel faster and harsher than it actually is. This is one of those movies that I would love to just break down as, like, this is an example of good film editing. Like, probably the clearest example. Absolutely. I've had of that since Mad Max Fury Road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's one of those things where, kind of like with Mad Max for a big action movie, but, like, for this with horror, it's, like, to execute a, like, genre movie really well, you need to get those fundamentals down fucking perfect. You know, to be able to build the suspense of a scene like the home invasion scene, you have to have incredibly solid fundamentals to be able to build that tension, show everything that is happening to the viewer, have it all be clear, and develop that tension, as you said, between multiple different storylines, requires an incredible amount of talent and skill from everyone on the team. But one of the things I do love about the movie is that you have that in that sequence of the home invasion, and then all the main members of the family survive, and then they come back together. Yes. And then they're together for almost the rest of the movie until the son gets kidnapped again. And that's something you just never see. You never see the whole family survive a horror movie. Like, I was not expecting everyone to live. Like, I was 100% expecting one of the kids or the husband. In fact, I thought Winston Duke was going to get killed pretty early on.
I did too. Like, because,
like, hobbled.
Well, I think they're specifically playing on that, because in most home invasion movies, the thing that happens early on is the main character's spouse dies. You know, like, that's just,
yes,
very common. You know, like, you know, Ash never goes into that cabin in Evil Dead and comes out with the girlfriend he started with, right? Like, mm-hmm. She's toast, yeah, every time. And so I totally thought the way they were doing it, like, Winston's, he's toast, right? And not only is he not, he has the highest kill count for a while, as he points out to us. And I think there is something kind of genuinely subversive about letting the family live and be together and develop those dynamics. It's so rich.
Yeah, and it then allows that, like, peculiar tone where all of a sudden, like, the family you're following starts becoming, like, they become more powerful than the doppelgangers because they are slowly winning. Like, they kill one whole family. And then they kill two whole families ultimately, but, you know, not till the very, very end of the movie. But they're slowly picking off the doppelgangers. And there's something I think about that with the message of the movie, particularly once you find out that the mother, the Lupita Nyong'o character, is ultimately was the doppelganger the entire time that escaped from the facility, there's something about that inversion of, oh, they're the ones that are the killers. And not only are they killing, they seem weirdly fine with it and are like weirdly accepting about it. In a way that is both exciting for me as a viewer because it undercuts and like just skips the whole like, I can't believe I killed someone. I've taken another human life. Blah, 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 blah. Like that whole thing that's like in every fucking zombie movie or whatever, you know, it's like at a certain point, I'm really just tired of seeing that plot beat in these kinds of movies. So there's something really nice about just being able to skip that and allow the daughter to just kill a motherfucker with a golf club. Like, that's just cool, and I'm cool with that, and just being able to do that. But then the ultimate effect that that has on the movie is really interesting, because it makes... it kind of estranges you a little bit from the main characters in a way that I've never seen in a horror movie like this, because they start becoming a little bit too effective, and they start becoming a little bit too unaffected by the things that they are doing. That's one of the things that I want to watch the movie again for, is seeing how that turn occurs, because it goes from being what feels like a really well executed but fairly predictable home invasion doppelganger story to a more like vaguely zombie-esque survival story where the main characters are actually succeeding.
Yeah.
And that's really cool.
Let's break down just how dark this ending is, because it's fascinating.
Okay, yeah.
Because I'm still digesting how dark it is, because it's hard to take in when they present it to you. But the whole idea, if you untangle it, is the character we follow at the beginning, the little girl, is a little girl who has had a nice, happy family life. Her dad's a little bit of a deadbeat. He doesn't pay enough attention to her, but it's okay. You know, he's not a bad dad. And she goes into that Hall of Mirrors and never comes out. Because she goes in, she gets chained to a fucking bed, and she starts her life on the surface and then has to live the rest of it seething in anger for everything that has been taken from her, and thus orchestrates this uprising. Whereas the adult Lupita Nyong'o we follow, who we think is that same little girl, is someone who started having nothing and then comes out, and the trauma was realizing there's more to the world than she thought there was. And that is this like severe trauma, which already like that so complicates every Freudian idea you can throw at this movie, that like that also interests me, because I think a lot of movies that are Freudian bore me because they get so fucking literal with it. Like a lot of Hitchcock mm-hmm. is that way to me. It's why I love Lynch. It's never that simple. So that complicates it, like I said. But like so the realization is the character who went through more shit in life is the one we killed at the end of the movie and orchestrated this uprising. The person who had to go through more hell is this other person. And just that switch of, like, she was, like, the character we're rooting for Lupita Nyong'o to skewer with a fucking poker the whole movie is the little girl from the beginning who got taken away from her nice family life. And the person who did that kind of horrible act of violence that started the whole thing is her. And that just, that throws so many wrenches into so many ideas you could throw at this movie. It is so fascinating to me, and it is so dark, because also, as you say, they basically win. They kill two families. They're home free. They're in a car. There's a bunch of doppelgangers out there, but guess what? Like, Adelaide is a doppelganger. She can probably, like, prove it and be the queen of all of them, because she's the one who is intelligent and talks and can be the bridge between the two societies. It's very, very dark in terms of, like, the power that is amassed by the end of the movie, and the illusion that has been overcome and reopened, you know?
Yeah, and that's just the darkness within the main family with that twist. But then also, I mean, the last shot of the movie is a shot of all the doppelgangers joining hands across America in their red jumpers or whatever, and you see them across, you know, Mountain's Majesty, basically, and the realization that, oh, I guess that means that basically everybody else in America is basically dead, or like most of them, presumably, if all the doppelgangers are coming out and stabbing their originals and killing their original families and trying to end up replacing them. But it's like they're not even really replacing them, because, you know, other than maybe, I guess, like, I don't know, there's no information about what other countries are doing. It has to be like localized in America, for as far as we can tell. But if you ignore the rest of the world, it seems just like the doppelgangers just took over. Like, they did it. Like, they killed everybody. It's like, we're good. But they killed everybody, and in so doing kind of also accomplished nothing, because joining hands across America and doing this big demonstration, the demonstration that Red wanted to do to show everybody what they have caused in their ignorance of like living their lives and not acknowledging what has been going down or not questioning the tunnels and the aid or whatever, however you want to read it. Like, it's this like kind of futile protest in the way that the Hands Across America historically was a futile protest against poverty, and all the killing and everything that has been done in this film feels like it comes to ultimately nothing and gains nothing for any real party.
Yeah. And again, the place the main family now has in the new world is really interesting to think about. You know? Mm-hmm. It something Jordan Peele is so good at in both this and Get Out is they both ultimately have fairly heady sci-fi premises if you think about it. Like, Get Out is about transferring people's brains into other bodies. This is about this weird idea of the tether and cloning or something. We don't know. And he doesn't get bogged down in the details. He doesn't stop and do technobabble. He doesn't give you a history of how it happened. They don't go through the science. It's just there that makes it so much more interesting. It makes it so much scarier, particularly in this case, I think. You never... Get Out does this really well. You never know more than the characters know. And the characters don't know things because of weird writing contrivances. It's very naturalistically done. Like it is... I don't know, these movies are just, his movies so far are just so eminently polished, and I appreciate the hell out of that, you know?
Yeah, because there was a moment near the end where I was, when she started going down into the lab in the basement, I was starting to get a little bit concerned that it was going to become too much, like, oh shit, now we're going to get, like, this big explanation, there's going to be some fucking scientist or someone down here that's going to give us the big explanation, and it's going to, like, tell us way too much. And instead, he does the smart thing of, like, you definitely find out more and you get, like, I think a good grounding in the sense of, like, okay, this is where the doppelgangers come from and this is basically what they are. But it never gives you too much. Like, in the amount it gives you kind of leaves you with more questions about, like, the fuck is with all the fucking rabbits? what's really going, like, what are they learning in this classroom, you know? Like, what's going on down here? You, like, what was the ultimate objective of this project and who ran the project? You only get like a line or two from Red sort of vaguely saying, like, she's like, I think that they were trying to create us down here so that they could use us to control the people that lived up top, but it didn't work that way. Instead, we were being controlled by the people that lived up top, and so they just abandoned us down here. And so, like, that's the only real explanation you were given for the project, and that's enough.
Here's how good a piece of filmmaking this is. The biggest slice of exposition you get about how this all works has zero words attached to it. It's the sequence where they're doing the fight, mm-hmm. and you're cutting between them to see, you know, the dancing, which is the little... Or you're actually cutting back to a lot of the opening prologue, where everything she's doing, the doppelganger, is being made to do down below, right? And so you're getting this visual exposition, frankly, about like how this works, which is that every action up here is causing a really damaging and fierce reaction down here, which obviously is a very loaded idea that gets into a lot of stuff about double consciousness, just basic systems of poverty in a capitalistic system, which is that to have any material wealth means someone else is denied it. You know, all of those ideas are coming into play, but not a word of that has to be spoken. It is pure visual, and much of it is tied to this climactic fight between characters. The economy of that is staggering from a storytelling standpoint to me.
Yeah, and that it's not something that has to be conveyed through, again, like some like weird scientist character, or it doesn't have to be, you know, it's not something that's conveyed in the like opening scrawl of text that is usually the thing reserved that a movie has to be like, let's get a really dry piece of exposition across immediately. In the first 5 seconds of our movie, instead, that piece of information is practically useless. It's just like, okay, there are tunnels. All right, okay,
yeah,
tunnels, cool.
Oh, and man, I mean, because again, I don't want to lose sight. This is a funny fucking movie too. Like, mm-hmm. like sometimes it's not always laugh out loud because it's so dark. But there is a playfulness to it that I think helps. It's the same as like a David Lynch, where David Lynch's movies are at their best when they are playful, and you can have the very dark, serious stuff, but also, like, he's just a fucking goofball. There is no other explanation for putting the concrete tunnels thing at the beginning, because you don't technically need it for the movie, right? You put it there because Jordan Peele's a little bit of a rascally rabbit, we might say, using an image from the film. It's just to, like, it's to fuck with you. And I don't know, you take a step back and look at it, and as much as there is going on here, and as smart as it is, it's also just kind of hilarious to do this all with the fucking stupid DIA tunnels thing. Like that's amazing to me. You know, and having the pullout on the bunnies and all of that. And that bunnies are the, like, you know, the weird monster in this movie. And there is something kind of creepy about bunnies. It's presented very well. But I also think there's this, like, kind of funny other side to it.
Yeah, definitely.
So is there anything else to say about Us? I think you guys can tell that we love it.
Yeah, it's a good fucking movie. I look forward to watching it again at some point.
Oh, God, yeah.
Because it is, yeah, it's really good. And it's, like, it's both really good and it is, like, really to my taste, specifically for horror. Like I said earlier, I just love doppelganger stuff. I think it's such a cool subgenre of horror that very rarely is ever really explored. Like, there's some stuff, I mean, I think one of the most prominent examples of doppelganger stuff comes from The Twilight Zone. So it's appropriate enough that Jordan Peele's covering The Twilight Zone now. You know, and then stuff like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, that is close to, like, a doppelganger thing. It's a little different. But yeah, so it's like those kinds of stories always really interest me a lot, and it's really cool to just get this, like, really masterfully executed one of those. I'm just very pleased to have that in my life.
I love that this movie made $70 million opening weekend. That is so... That people are going to look back on that, and like a film student is going to watch Us and feel like they've discovered something amazing, you know, because maybe in 20 years it's not being talked about every day. And they're like, this is amazing. I got to look up this movie. This must have been, like, some weird, like, kind of, like, art house hit he had to, like, scrap to get made, and it probably wasn't well received in its day because, oh, I know, the 2010s were when all the superhero movies were making money, and he's gonna look at, like, it made what? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's gonna be that kind of thing. And that's awesome. It is such a fucking outlier for, like, this period in cinema. And we're in a really interesting moment for horror because the finances exist to do a lot of cool stuff with it. But this feels like a cut above. It's wild.
Yeah, I mean, I think we will, and we'll see, like, how long this sort of horror movie thing continues, but I think we will look back on the 2010s for sure as, like, a really powerful decade for horror filmmaking. Because there's just been, you know, I don't think I talked about it on the podcast, but like a couple of months ago, I watched Hereditary, which came out last year. Like, that movie's fucking amazing. Like, there's just been stuff like that, Babadook, It Follows, The Witch. Like, there's just so many, and, like, Get Out, obviously, so many just incredible fucking horror movies that have been coming out.
I need to catch up on more of them because I have this, like, weird internal bias where I think my markers for horror are from a different era. Like, because I grew up with, like, Saw and shit, and so I just kind of programmed myself to be like, because those aren't worth fucking watching, you know? So, like, I grew up in the era where horror was torture porn, and so now that I'm an adult, I don't seek it out. And yet, clearly, some of the best art being made every year is there. So, I need to do a better job at that. And I think Jordan Peele is actually bringing a lot of people like me into the fold, because I went to go see Get Out for Jordan Peele, because I knew him from other things. I didn't go into it for the horror of it, and that's just, there's a great element of, like, using his existing talent as a Trojan horse to bring people into things they might not otherwise watch, you know?
Yeah, because definitely the 2000s, I think, was a really weak decade overall for horror films because it was filled with stuff like Saw, so you had, like, a lot more torture porn stuff, and then you started getting all the Paranormal Activity and, like, you started getting a lot of found footage stuff. But yeah, like, particularly the latter half of the 2010s, I think, has just been this unbelievably rich period for really interesting psychological takes on horror that have all been to my, like, taste. It's like it has moved back into, like, what I like in horror film, and it's just I feel so spoiled because most horror film stuff is so bad usually, and we've just gotten so much good shit. This has made so much money. I am extremely excited to see what Jordan Peele does next.
I can't even imagine.
It's a horror movie, or he makes the martial arts kung fu movie that I now really want him to at least try making, because that would be... Because I would like to see him try his hand at another genre as much as I would like to see another horror film. I think it'd be cool to see him stretch out and do something very different. But this is, like as strong a fucking 1-2 punch a director can have in terms of a filmography. It's incredibly impressive.
Yeah. All right. Well, good on you, Jordan Peele. We're excited for your next movie. I have to say, I walked out of the film, opened, you know, my phone, and there was all the news about the fucking Mueller report. And I was just like, I wish Jordan Peele had another movie in theaters right now so I could go back in and not have to deal with this fucking bullshit. Anyway, we will be back next week. Sean, you're going to be on spring break. You want to do Two Towers next week?
I think I can probably swing that.
Okay, if not now, I don't know when, so let's do it. That'll be next week. I am excited to watch more Lord of the Rings, and we'll cover some other stuff, and we'll see where we go from there.
Yep, and we'll just have to, you know, be very diligent that we don't get murdered by our doppelgangers and have them take over the podcast, because I think an entire podcast is just... would not be very fun.